You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with a November 2nd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. This is, of course, the first Wednesday of November, and as Joy LeClaire, who normally hosts Forthright Radio on the first and third Wednesdays, told you last week, we exchanged dates. As it happens, last week I was participating in a panel at UC Berkeley, sponsored by the Italian Cultural Institute, to discuss Seize the Time, a film on the Black Panthers made by a close friend of mine, the late Italian filmmaker Antonello Branca. Shot in 1968 and 69 and completed in 1971, its contents are sadly all too relevant today, as is the story of the Black Panthers, founded in Oakland in 1966, whose surviving members are currently celebrating the party's 50th anniversary and inspiring many members of the movement for black lives of the present generation. Back in the late 60s, the Panthers also inspired and worked with groups like the Brown Berets from the Chicano community, the Iwar Kun and the Red Guard from the Asian community, the Young Lords from New York's Puerto Rican neighborhoods, and the American Indian Movement, which grew out of the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. One can trace a direct line from the taking over of Alcatraz 47 years ago to the occupation and protest by the Standing Rock Sioux and their Indian and non-Indian allies against the building of that oil pipeline in North Dakota, which has been ongoing for months and most recently has been facing an escalation in state-ordered violence. When President Obama and his chosen successor Hillary Clinton will weigh in on this is anybody's guess, although I understand Obama did make a statement this morning. But the only pressure thus far for Clinton to do or say something about it is an online petition asking her to take action to stop the building of the pipeline after she is in office. That's a sad commentary on both Clinton and those of her supporters who claim to be concerned about Standing Rock. To quote the late Kurt Vonnegut, so it goes. Well, last week, Joy LeClaire also conveyed our sincerest thanks to those of you who pledged to KZYX during our extremely successful October 19th fundraising program. We would not be here without your continued support, so thank you from the bottom of our hearts. By this time next week, when I'm back with you for my regular second Wednesday program, we will probably know who will be our next president. I say probably because nothing in this made-in-hell presidential campaign resembles any that we have seen before and with luck we'll never see again. And so next Wednesday, rather than bringing you some knowledgeable guests to comment on the results, I will be opening the phones to get your takes on what happened and where the nation's headed. Of one thing we can be sure, this nation will still be at war, it will still have troops in most of the countries of the world, and will still be divided, and dangerously so, in a way that our country has not been since the Civil War. On the war front, it's already promises to be anything but the status quo. Even with election days away, the Pentagon is making preparations to expand the war in Syria, as last Thursday's New York Times reported. Citing senior Defense Department and military officials, the papers Helene Cooper and Eric Schmidt wrote that, quote, "The fight to retake Raqqa, the Syrian city that serves as the capital of the Islamic State, must begin soon, within weeks, to disrupt planning believed to be underway there to stage terrorist attacks on the West," end quote. Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, the top American military commander in Iraq, not surprisingly, declined to name a specific threat against Western targets emanating from Raqqa, according to the Times, but described a, quote, "sense of urgency," unquote. He said it was imperative that operations to isolate the city begin soon to prevent attacks on the West that could be launched or planned from the militants' capital. This is just an excuse, of course, like Iraq's so-called weapons of mass destruction, to justify the warmakers in Washington escalating our involvement in the Syrian morass, which constitute no direct threat to the United States, since there is no evidence that any terrorist attack in this country originated from Syria. The assault on Raqqa will apparently be taking place even as the U.S., providing support from the air, pushes a mixture of Iraqi forces to eject the Islamic State or ISIL from Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, which it has occupied for the past 2 years. To contrast how the media is covering the U.S.-led offensive in Mosul, and contrast it, with how it is reporting on the Russian-backed efforts of the Syrian government to retake Aleppo, Syria's second largest city, from al-Qaeda-linked fighters. I'll be speaking again with Robert Perry, the award-winning journalist at Consortium News, at 20 minutes past the hour. We'll also be talking about a New York Times reporter on the ground in missions Saturday at the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda's Syrian franchise, as Washington's indisputable ally in the war against Syrian President Bashar Assad. So stay tuned for that. The planned assault on Raqqa, according to the details provided by the Times, seems to be a prescription for chaos. First of all, it is ignoring the objections of Turkey, a critical U.S. ally and NATO member, to include Kurdish forces in the operation, since it fears that aspirations for autonomy may spread among its own Kurdish population, with whom it has been in a state of conflict for decades. General Townsend stressed that Kurdish militia fighters would be part of the ground force used to isolate Raqqa. Sounding as if he had taken English lessons from Donald Rumsfeld, he told reporters at the Pentagon during a video news briefing from Baghdad that, quote, "We're going to go with who can go, who's willing to go soon. And then once we get the initial isolation in position, we'll look at how we prosecute the operation further," end quote. Well, hope you understood that. Turkey considers the Syrian Kurdish fighters known as the YPG to be an extension of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PPK, the Kurdish rebel group that has sought autonomy from Turkey since the 1980s. Ankara, which was largely responsible for allowing Islamic State fighters into Syria in the first place, has demanded that the YPG not take part in the fight to retake Raqqa. U.S. military officials say the YPG personnel are the best fighters they have. "Well, the facts are these," said General Townsend. "The only force that's capable on any near-term timeline is the Syrian Democratic Forces, of which the YPG are a significant portion," end quote. While he intends for the Kurds to make up the bulk of the operations, Townsend said many of the more than 300 American Special Operation Forces now in Syria would help recruit, train, and equip local forces in and around Raqqa who are predominantly Syrian Arabs. They've done that before. It hasn't worked very well. Well, the impending operation is further complicated, the Times reporters note, because neither the Turks nor the Syrian Kurds view the recapture of Raqqa as a priority. They quote Christopher Kozak, a Syria researcher at the Institute for the Study of War, as saying that what the fighting in Syria so far has consistently demonstrated that, quote, "the Syrian Kurdish YPG do not truly desire to shed blood to capture a majority Sunni Arab city far from their vision of their autonomous borders, while Turkey cares about the operation only insofar as the Syrian Kurdish YPG is not allowed to participate in it," end quote. In other words, General Townsend views the Kurds as mercenaries. Whether they will suddenly become willing to die to fulfill the Pentagon's agenda, we'll have to wait and see. I very much doubt it. Whether Turkish President Recep Erdogan will allow the Kurds to do so, should they so choose, is also open to question, since he had previously used U.S. fighter jets provided by the Obama administration to attack the Islamic State instead to attack the Kurds. The remarks of U.S. War Secretary Ashton Carter on the situation reveal him to be as clueless as anyone who has held that position. He said in Brussels last Wednesday that the offensive to oust the Islamic State from Raqqa would begin within weeks. Quote, "This is, as always, a matter when you're positioning forces and so forth. We have a plan to do that and a schedule to do that," end quote, Mr. Carter told reporters. "We're going to execute that plan," end quote. Meanwhile, on Friday, the Alliance of Foreign Jihadists and Syrian Rebels in Aleppo launched what Times reporters based in Beirut describe as a major offensive against government positions in the western part of the city. This they depicted as a strong sign that rebel forces vetted by the United States were continuing their tactical alliances with groups linked to al-Qaeda, rather than distancing themselves as Russia has demanded and Washington has urged. Russia has reserved the right to attack anyone working with al-Qaeda-linked groups, saying there is little distinction between them. The rebels argue that they cannot afford to shun any potential allies while they are under fire, including well-armed and motivated jihadists, without more robust aid from their international backers, the Saudis, Qatar, United States, and so on. Eastern Aleppo, where the opposition is based, has a population estimated at 250,000, while as many as 1.5 million live in the government-controlled western part of the city. The latter have been under constant shelling from the al-Qaeda-linked forces, but his victims have yet to merit the space in the U.S. media afforded to those in the East. Leading the offensive has been the Levant Conquest Front, formerly known as the Nusra Front, which was part of al-Qaeda and another hardline Islamist faction, Ara al-Sham. The unfortunate truth, however, is that the U.S.-backed groups remain somewhat dependent upon the al-Qaeda-linked groups for organization and firepower in these operations, says Jean-Vive Casagrande, a Syria research analyst at the Institute for the Study of War in Washington. Ironically, the new offensive brought to an end a week-long ceasefire unilaterally declared by the Russians, who dropped leaflets calling for civilians and rebels to leave the eastern districts of Aleppo through humanitarian corridors, warning that anyone who stayed could be killed. There'll be more on this story, of course, when I speak with Bob Perry in just a few minutes. On the past broadcasts, I have mentioned that one of the most censored stories in the U.S. media has been the fact that the Lebanese political party, an anti-Israel resistance group, Hezbollah, has been in a formal alliance for more than a decade with the largest of the country's Maronite Christian parties, the Free Patriotic Movement, and its leader, a former general as well as a former president of Lebanon, Michel Aoun. The reason for the silence is obvious. The mainstream media takes its cues from the Israel lobby. Consequently, it routinely portrays Hezbollah as if it was a Shia version of al-Qaeda or even the Islamic State, which it has been fighting in Syria, neglecting to mention that it emerged as a resistance movement to Israel's occupation of Lebanon following its 1982 invasion of that country. On Monday, spreading that Israeli propaganda became a challenge. When, as Israel's Haaretz reported, quote, Lebanon's parliament elected Hezbollah-backed Michel Aoun president after 2.5 years of having the position unfilled. The New York Times continued to knuckle under, not even mentioning Aoun in his Tuesday headlines and not a hint about his ties to Hezbollah. Aoun's election is being seen by Israel and its supporters as a major victory for what it calls the Iran-Syria-Hezbollah axis and a critical setback for Saudi Arabia, which has long backed Lebanon's Sunni-led March 14th alliance. The account in Haaretz, which is a frequent critic of Israeli government policies, was more tactful, noting that, quote, many in Lebanon and the Arab world see the election as an opening for optimism in the region, and possibly a sign of Saudi Arabia's weakening as a sponsor of many parties and political organizations in the Arab world, and in particular Hariri's anti-Syrian March 14th alliance, end quote. Hariri refers to Saeed Hariri, son of former Lebanese prime minister and Saudi ally, multi-billionaire builder Rafik Hariri, who was assassinated by a car bomb in Beirut in 2005 that was blamed on Syria. As part of the agreement to support Aoun's candidacy, Hariri will become prime minister, charged with forming a government under Lebanon's political system, in which the president must be a Maronite Christian, the prime minister a Sunni, and the speaker of parliament a Shia. Aoun, speaking after his election, alluded to the conflict with Israel, saying, quote, we will always be ready to help and support the resistance forces in order to liberate every last meter of Lebanese territory that has not yet been returned and the attempts to take over natural resources, end quote. Aoun was referring in that last part to Israel's long-held desire to control the waters of Lebanon's Litani River, which was one of the reasons it had launched its war in 1982, ostensibly to eliminate the PLO. When I was last in Beirut in the fall of 2007, I spent 45 minutes in conversation with Michel Aoun, who told me that the basis for his support for Hezbollah was that without the resistance group, the Israelis would simply take over Lebanon as it had following the 1982 invasion. At that time, it became clear that Israel had no intention of leaving southern Lebanon. The following year, when I was there, its troops began treating the country's Shia population as sadistically as they treated the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. With the backing of Iran and support of the majority of the Lebanese people, Hezbollah emerged and began an armed struggle to rid the country of its Israeli occupiers. 17 years later, in 2000, under pressure from mothers who were seeing too many of their sons killed, the Israelis unilaterally withdrew from all but a small section of land, which remains a flashpoint to this day. That was what Aoun was referring to when he spoke of liberating every last meter of Lebanese territory that has not yet been returned, end quote. The new president also pledged to confront the issue of refugees arriving from Syria in order to return them to their homeland. With regard to the Palestinian refugees, we shall always aspire to implement the right of return for those refugees, end quote. As Haaretz's Lebanese correspondent Jacques Houri described it, an Aoun victory marks a remarkable turn of fortune for the former general who fought two wars in the late 1980s at the end of Lebanon's 1975-90 civil war, one against Syria and the other against rival Christian forces. His subsequent alliance with Hezbollah, backed by its Syrian and Iranian patrons, helped to cement divisions in the once dominant Maronite Christian community, wrote Khoury. But it also angered the United States, which views Hezbollah, a heavily armed group and Syria's strongest Lebanese ally, as a terrorist organization. His election will also be viewed as a victory for Hezbollah, Tehran, and Damascus over Hariri Sunni allies in Riyadh at a time when Saudi Arabia has appeared to retreat from Lebanon as it prioritizes fighting Iran in the Gulf. It will also raise questions over Western policy toward Lebanon, whose army depends on U.S. military aid, concluded Haaretz's Jacques Houri. Indeed, the U.S. Army Security Assistance Command delivered more than $50 million worth of weapons and military equipment to Lebanon to support the Middle East nation's counterterrorism battle on the Syrian border, according to the Army's webpage. A Navy charter carrying 50 Humvees, 40 howitzers, 15,000 mortars, 300,000 50-caliber rounds, grenade launchers, and Hellfire air-to-surface missiles left North Carolina's military ocean terminal, Sunny Point, the largest military terminal in the world, docking at the port of Beirut on August 8th. Following the elections, expect the new situation in Lebanon to get Congress's attention. And speaking of elections, a newly released audio has revealed that then-Senator Hillary Clinton lamented the United States' failure to rig the 2006 Palestinian elections, which saw Hamas defeat the Western-backed Fatah. The recording is from a meeting that September between Clinton, representing New York, and the Brooklyn-based right-wing Jewish Press newspaper. Of the Palestinian election the previous January, she says, quote, "I do not think we should have pushed for an election in the Palestinian territories. I think it was a big mistake. If we are going to push for an election," she said, "then we should have made sure we did something to determine who is going to win," end quote, as the Democratic National Committee did for her in the case of Bernie Sanders. Hamas won 74 of 132 seats, compared to Fatah's 45 seats, an election deemed free and fair by international observers. George W. Bush's Republican administration backed the elections and accepted the outcome, and there hasn't been another Palestinian election since. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. I want to begin by talking about an anti-colonialist project. Not Palestine, although that is involved, but Standing Rock. We live at a time when solidarity movements talk about intersectionality, the linking of movements because of their commonality. This Week in Palestine features the Palestinian voice expressing the Palestinian narrative, and that is where we begin today, with the words of Nada Elia, a Palestinian scholar, writer, and grassroots organizer. As a Palestinian, the resistance of Native Americans at Standing Rock resonates with her, as it does with many others. Standing up to the colonizers unites the oppressed. The following are excerpts from an article featured in Mondo Weiss. Nada Elia writes, and I quote, "Once again, I seem to be glued to my monitor, this time streaming live scenes of the confrontations at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Thousands of unarmed civilians are being attacked by heavily militarized police and private security as they seek to protect their lands, their natural resources, their cultural heritage. Succinctly expressing the outrage of many over the latest violations by the United States of a treaty with the indigenous nations of this continent, Stephen Salada wrote a post on Facebook that immediately went viral. Quote, "The current buildup of tremendous force at Standing Rock should be understood as a military invasion of a sovereign nation on behalf of a foreign oil company," unquote. And once again, as they have for centuries, the rightful owners of this land are determined to defend it, its life-giving water, its sacredness as a repository of culture. This time, the water protectors are calling for support, solidarity, greater numbers, and thousands of activists are joining them or sending what they can from widely circulating lists of supplies. The Standing Rock Sioux Nation's defiant resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline seems to have galvanized grassroots popular support throughout the United States as well as globally. Individuals and groups, many representing indigenous nations, are heeding the call to come stand with the protectors. Standing Rock matters, even if we are not all impacted. Of course, the intersections between Standing Rock and the struggles and resistance of various other communities are many. Palestinians see themselves in the Sioux, a long vilified nation still standing strong against the onslaught of settler colonialism. "Standing Rock is Palestine," one friend asserted as he announced his decision to go to the warrior camp for a second time. Nada Raja Tanos, who was part of a Palestinian caravan that recently went there from California, wrote eloquently, passionately, about the intersections between the Palestinian and the Sioux resistance to settler colonialism, land dispossession, theft of resources. "Why did I go in the first place? Because somewhere in the awkward power dynamic of being a U.S. citizen, a non-native inhabitant of Turtle Island, and a Palestinian in the diaspora, I saw the struggle for livelihood and culture. The struggle against settler colonialism, the struggle to protect the sacred and maintain your own legitimacy, and the ever ominous force of erasure and historical amnesia." Black Lives Matters also issued a statement noting the many connections between the two disenfranchised, criminalized communities. Quote, "As there are many diverse manifestations of blackness, and black people are also displaced indigenous peoples, we are clear that there is no black liberation without indigenous sovereignty. Environmental racism is not limited to pipelines on indigenous land, because we know that the chemicals used for fracking and the materials used to build pipelines are also used in water containment and sanitation plants in black communities like Flint, Michigan, unquote. Climate change activists are also heading to Standing Rock, outraged at the thought of yet one more pipeline potentially poisoning the soil. It is not a matter of if a pipeline breaks, it is a matter of when a pipeline breaks. There are no safe pipelines. A spill will threaten drinking water for thousands of people, including the majority of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation. A spill will destroy critical farmlands of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois, one group wrote in their manifesto. For many, the greater concern is not about the violation of Sioux sovereignty, but rather with a national dependence on fossil fuel and the environmental devastation any and all pipelines cause. The rallying cry seems to be, keep it in the ground, not respect indigenous sovereignty and sacred sites. But it is indigenous sovereignty and the Standing Rock Sioux Nation that matters. One of the most positive developments in activism over the past few years has been the growth and widespread understanding of intersectionality. An intersectional analysis allows us to identify and name manifestations of injustice as we experience them, even as we acknowledge that our experiences are similar but not the same as those of other communities. Thus, we stand with communities suffering from the same oppressive system, such as racism, for example, even if the manifestations of that oppressive system are experienced differently based on one's perceived race. Grounded in intersectional analysis, Palestine activists, environmentalists, etc., see themselves in and at Standing Rock. But Standing Rock isn't about Palestine. Standing Rock isn't about black lives. Standing Rock isn't about climate change. Standing Rock is about all of this and all of us together. But ultimately, Standing Rock matters because it is about the Sioux Nation and the indigenous people of this land. Indeed, settler colonialism never ended on Turtle Island. It is ongoing with daily violations of indigenous rights and treaties with the sovereign nations. When the water protectors say water is life, it is because their very survival is at stake. And as we respond, as we come together from all the nations of the globe, we reinforce the bonds of indigenous and transactional grassroots resistance that makes up greater than the sum of our parts. But ultimately, in whatever connections we may make to better understand this standoff at Standing Rock, we must center our indigenous concerns in this battle. Standing Rock is about indigenous sovereignty. As I follow the developments from my home in Salish land, I am humbled by the resistance of the rightful owners of this land over the five centuries since they were first colonized. Let us center their concerns, their rights, their history, as we stand with them always, literally, on their grounds. That was an excerpt from an article by Nada Elaya in Mondo Weiss. And now moving on. On Saturday, October 29th, a forum was held in Cambridge to address and help organize against the pushback by pro-Israeli groups to counter the worldwide Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Two of the keynote speakers, Nadia Ben Youssef of the Palestinian legal organization Adela and Tamar Rabin of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, address the gathering, and we feature their presentations this morning on This Week in Palestine. The forum was organized by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, Mass Peace Action, and Jewish Voice for Peace. Here are Nadia Ben Youssef and Tamar Gavin.
So first we have Nadia Ben Youssef, who is a lawyer and human rights advocate, serving as Adala, which is the legal center for Arab minority rights in Israel. And she's the first USA representative. After 4 years leading Adala's international advocacy efforts on behalf of the indigenous Palestinian Bedouin community in the Nakab, or Negev, she is now developing the organization's U.S. Advocacy strategy to influence American policy and practice in Israel-Palestine. Much of her work in the United States has focused on building a transnational movement against supremacy and state sanction violence, together with cause lawyers, community organizers, and artists across diverse movements for social justice. Nadia is a member of the New York State Bar and holds a BA in Sociology from Princeton University and a JD from the Boston College Law School. Welcome, Nadia. Tamar Gavin is a Palestinian-American organizer who works for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, just recently formerly the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. They just changed their name. As the Government Affairs Associate, additionally, she is currently the head of distribution for the Arab Students Institute's new pedagogical project, Gaza in Context. Tamar received her BA in International Affairs from Northeastern University in 2015. And as an undergrad, she was very active in the Students for Justice in Palestine and continues to be connected to SJP as an alumna. Susan Nicholson, welcome, Tamar. And Tamar is joining us all the way from D.C., so we're happy to have you come up. Thank you. So the three organizations that are worked on this event are Mass Peace Action, the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine. That banner has not been corrected yet. We do have changed our name. And Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP. And so we all three are in a group called the Joint Advocacy Group. As we were doing legislative work, it seemed silly to be doing it separately. And we thought, to combine forces and really figure out how to make this attack a joint effort. It's resisting the attack on us. So, we hope you find this morning's session interesting and engaging so that we leave here educated and fired up to protect our right to boycott as we continue our work on BDS in support of Palestinian justice and liberation. Thank you all. Oh, one last thing. I just want to do a shout out to Standing Rock and show our solidarity.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Thank you to the organizers and certainly for all of you for being here 10 a.m. on a Saturday. I'm thrilled to be here with you, and I hope that it is a time for us to reflect, to build, to catch courage from one another, to start thinking strategically about what our movement for justice looks like. We've talked a little bit about how we're going to organize the day, and you've seen, we're going to take you through a little bit of history, what's going on the ground, what's happening across the country, what's happening in Massachusetts, and then you'll break up into groups to really start thinking about what you can do, how we build power. And so hopefully by 1 o'clock you have a lot of information, you have a lot of energy, and you know kind of steps forward. This is going to be a very encouraging morning. You're going to hear a lot about the powers against movements for social change, whether that's in Palestine, whether that's here in the United States, and it can feel discouraging because that power is strong. Students feel it every day on campuses. You'll hear about that. We feel it as civil society, as human rights organizations. You feel it as organizers, as community members. That power can feel very, very strong. But I think, hopefully, what you'll understand kind of at the end of this is that this is a very common tactic, to suppress activism and organizing. And it's, I think, very much a signal of how powerful we are. I think the response becomes much stronger the more that we build power. The response of those in power to try to silence those voices, to try to suppress protests and activism and organizing and certainly building coalitions is a sign, I think, that we're winning. I'm a human rights lawyer, so I'm eternally and relentlessly optimistic. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, you wouldn't be here, but I think that's true. So what I would like to do is kind of provide a background to situate the emergence of this tactic, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, in terms, yes, of the struggle for freedom, justice, and equality in Palestine, but more broadly, in terms of how it's a symbol and a tactic and a tool of all struggles for justice around the world. So what I hope, too, is that when we leave, we're not just fired up for Palestine. You ended with a call of solidarity for Standing Rock. These struggles are interconnected in so many ways, because these are struggles against structures and systems of oppression. They are struggles against settler, colonial, legal, political regimes. They are struggles against white supremacy. They are struggles against hierarchies of human life, hierarchies of rights. And so when we think about what our role is as organizers, as activists, as artists, as people who are concerned with justice in Palestine, as I know you are, this is why you're here, I want us to think that we are here not just because of that, but because we're concerned about a struggle for justice more broadly. So what I want to do is maybe bring us into some sort of a history about what's going on the ground, where this came from, what this struggle is about, and tell you a little bit about how Adana, as an organization, Palestinian human rights organization and legal center based in Israel, is challenging that on the ground, and then how it relates to your work here. So where does this come from? Again, I want to just reiterate what the call of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is. We have to remember what that is. Ending the occupation. If you don't know it in your head, write it down. Ending the occupation. So this is the occupation, the Israeli military occupation of Palestinian lands, the West Bank, including Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, ending the military occupation, which turns 50 next year. Turns 50 years old next year. 50 years of a military occupation. End the occupation, that's a call. But what's interesting is how this call then moves very quickly into two important points. Certainly ending the occupation. Then it goes to what we call a demand for historic justice. A demand for historic justice. That takes us to what's known as the Nakba. Is everyone familiar with that term? Are people familiar with that term? The Nakba, for those who are not familiar, means catastrophe in Arabic. The Nakba. It means catastrophe in Arabic and refers to the events of 1948 when the state of Israel was established. The vast majority of Palestinians became refugees, lost their land. The ethnic cleansing of Palestine begins here, the Nakba. And the ongoing Nakba is what the struggle for historic justice is about, right? So this, certainly the Nakba sounds like a historic moment. It sounds like something that has passed, has not passed. The effects of the Nakba are seen throughout the system of Israel, the system of the state of Israel, and we'll talk a little bit about that, how the system is designed, right? So the Nakba. The second call, one of the two next calls, is the right of return of refugees. So what happened during the Nakba? The vast majority of Palestinians became refugees. The second call of the boycott, divestment and sanctions call, is the return of refugees, historic justice, return of refugees. The final call refers to the Palestinians who remained inside Israel after the state was established. So the vast majority of Palestinians became refugees. A small number remained inside Israel. and became citizens of Israel in 1952 through the citizenship law. There were 150,000 Palestinians at that time who remained inside Israel to become citizens of Israel. They now make up 1.3 million people, or 20% of the population of Israel. One in five Israelis, Israeli citizens, is a Palestinian. One in five Israeli citizens is a Palestinian. The state of Israel was established as a Jewish state, right? It was established, we're going to get to why this is important, as a state that would privilege the rights of certain people on the basis of who they were. It's inherent in the Declaration of Independence. It's inherent in all the systems and structures and laws of the state of Israel, that we're going to create a state which privileges the rights and lives of certain people on the basis of who they are. The second call of the BDS, third, there's three, we're just moving. The third call that I'll discuss is equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel. So these calls, if we can summarize what it is, it's a call for historic justice. Historic justice, the return of refugees, the end of the occupation, and equality for all. These are human rights principles. It is a human rights-based call. This is a demand for historic justice and for equality. I want you to keep that in your arsenal. A few weeks ago, when we were talking about kind of organizing and going to Massachusetts State, the governor's office, to the attorney general to talk about this issue, the response was, I never knew this was about human rights. We thought this was about anti-Israel. We thought this was an anti-Semitic call. We're going to talk about that. We thought this was about discrimination against the Jewish people. We thought this was discrimination against Israeli settlers or Israelis. We didn't realize this was a call for human rights. This is a call for human rights, and it is protected on all sorts of levels. But just remember that it's a call for historic justice and for equality. I talked a little bit about how the system is designed. So, when the state of Israel was established, all of the laws, the policies, the practices were put in place to uphold its fundamental design. The state of Israel was established to privilege the rights of the Jewish people over anyone else on that land. It was established to privilege the rights of the Jewish people over anyone else on that land. The system was designed that way. When we think about what's going on in Israel now, which certainly, and we can talk about kind of the situation on the ground, which is degrading, certainly. It's a very scary situation on the ground for Palestinians, for human rights defenders, who are facing all sorts of real physical and other threats against their existence, certainly, all the time. So the situation on the ground is degrading, but we don't say that the system now is broken. In the same way that we don't say that the system in the United States is a broken system. It's not broken. The system is designed this way. The system isn't broken. The system is designed this way. In Israel, the system is, we're going to privilege the rights and the lives, the citizenship and the power of the Jewish people over non-Jewish people on that land, Palestinians, but it also extends to refugees, to asylum seekers. Anyone who is not Jewish on that land has fundamentally less rights to power, to land, to resources. The system is designed this way. So that includes the law, right? The law is not a powerful tool, we often say. I'm a lawyer. I was confused by that. That's why I went to law school. I was like, this is going to be a powerful tool. It is not a powerful tool. The law is a tool of the powerful. The law is a tool of the powerful. The law is a tool of the powerful. The law in Israel is a tool of the powerful, certainly. So we look to the legal regime as to understand how this works. And you're going to hear examples of how the law is a tool of the powerful. It's used to protect the status quo, to use to protect the systems and structures of oppression and of supremacy. Because who writes the laws? Who writes the laws? The powerful write the laws. Those in power write the laws. And those in power want to keep their power. Those in power want to keep their power. And anything that's a threat to that power, like the truth, like history, like justice, is going to be quashed. In 2011, so here we have just a bit of background in terms of where we were and how the struggle is playing out in Israel-Palestine, because I think it's really instructive about how it's playing out here and how you protect your rights to stand up, not for Palestinian rights, but to stand up against injustice wherever it happens. So here we go. In 2005, you have the call for boycott. Call for boycott, people are joining the call, including Israelis, including Jewish Israelis, Palestinian citizens of Israel, certainly Palestinians who are joining this call, who say, you know what, the system is designed, the system is rigged, Adela uses the system, I can talk about how we use the system and I'll tell you a story now, but the system is rigged, how do we change the situation? And as we talked about in the introduction, this is a time-honored tactic, because when the law is designed a certain way, you start thinking, what are the other tools for social change? What are the other tools? The law might be a tool for social change, we'll talk about that, but there are other tools for social change. International advocacy, creating and mobilizing public and public outrage, that's a tool of social change. So the boycott started making waves, right? So people started joining the call for boycott, including those who lived inside Israel. As a response to this growing movement, and you'll hear about how this is taking shape across the country, in response to this growing movement, the Israeli Knesset, so the Israeli parliament, in 2011 passed what's called the anti-boycott law. In 2011. So you're going to see, actually, you're going to see how this works. So you have 6 years of a growing movement for Palestinian rights, a growing movement that's calling into question the fundamental nature of this structure and system of oppression, right? And calling into question the historic injustice of the Palestinian people, making waves. It's growing. It's building. And so what do the powerful do? They make that growth of a movement illegal. Law is a tool of the powerful. They're going to make it illegal. So, anti-boycott law said, we're going to create a new civil tort, a new civil wrong. That a call for a boycott is a civil wrong. And you can be sued in court if you call for boycott. If you as an individual call for boycott, you can be sued in court. Anti-boycott law, that was one part. The second part, which you'll hear resonance of this in this country, and when you're hearing anti-boycott laws being passed here, you'll hear resonance. The second part was that if you are a public institution and you receive public funds, this law said those public funds can be taken away if you as an institution call for boycott. Adala, a legal center based in Israel, Palestinian human rights organization, partnered with another human rights organization. So Adela, if we're talking about historic times, Adela is like the NAACP of Israel. So Adela, the NAACP of Israel, partnered with ACRI, the ACLU of Israel, to challenge this, ACRI is the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, to challenge this before the Israeli Supreme Court. We challenge this before the Israeli Supreme Court, saying that it is a fundamental right. Under international law, under international human rights, we used all of these examples that were discussed, certainly the 1982 decision in the United States. We brought that in. We brought in examples from South Africa. We brought in examples, and we lost the case. No. We lost the case in a close decision, but we lost the case because the system is designed a certain way, right? The system is designed. It's not going to give you those rights. We lost the case, but it's important reasons why we lost the case. The discrimination argument was really huge, and I hope we get into that. I hope we start teasing out why that's a false argument. The idea that those in power can be discriminated against. Not true. Not true. Discrimination is a system and a structure of power. It's not about individual prejudice. That can exist. There can be individual prejudice, but systems and structures of oppression make it impossible for the oppressor to be discriminated against. They created the system of discrimination. It can be discriminated against. So, but that argument held in the Israeli Supreme Court. It's being used here as well, so discrimination. We lost that case, but which makes it very difficult for organizations, institutions, individuals inside Israel, including Adana, to call for a boycott. So we actually don't call for boycott. One, we're not a grassroots organizing. We're an institution. We are a legal center. So that's not part of our work, but it has a chilling effect. It silences those who are organizing for social change. We're fighting back. And people are fighting back. Because nothing, ultimately, this is getting a little too true, but it's true, can stop the power of the people. And I think that what we're seeing and what we're witnessing, again, as you're going to hear what's going on in this country, these like very similar laws being passed and being proposed in dozens of states are, I hope to you, again, just an indication of how far we are going, how far we are coming, how far we have come, how big this movement is, how you are on the right side of history. And when you choose the side of the oppressed, you will always be on the right side of history. So I encourage you not only to think about how this impacts your right to speak out for Palestinian justice, but how it empowers you to speak out against injustice wherever you see it. So I'm really excited to build with you. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, we have that built into the schedule. So thank you so much.
Good morning. Thank you all very much for having me today. I'm very happy to be back in Boston. So thank you to the organizers. Thank you all for coming out again on a Saturday morning. My name is Tamara Gubbin, and I'm the Government Affairs Associate at the newly renamed U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. And
is this better? Okay, I have to like
the mic.
Exactly.
All right. As was mentioned earlier, we just changed our name a few weeks ago to sort of to represent this more rights-based framework. We're not just about ending the occupation, but we're also about right of return and equal rights for Palestinians inside of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. So we think that this name represents that more. And I'm going to be talking about the fight against BDS repression. So, as Nadia did a very good job of sort of taking a step back and looking at this issue from both Palestine and Israel, I also want to sort of continue to do the same. I think that in the U.S. we have often a very like myopic view of our activism, especially when it comes to repression. So I just wanted to mention a few cases of what's happening on the international level. In Spain, in France, I just heard yesterday that in Northern Ireland, of all places, a council member of the Belfast City Council presented a pro-BDS motion, and the city council declared it illegal, which is crazy. It's Northern Ireland, so that's...
Well, no. Ireland, Ireland.
Sure.
Ireland.
Okay. But, I mean, it's indicative of, like, this more geopolitical global shift, especially with a party like Sinn Féin, which has traditionally been very pro-Palestine. Anyway, and then of course Palestine. This is why we do this work. Palestinians face repression every day. It's their lives. It's my family's lives. So I wanted to sort of just ground this talk and this whole day in both a recognition of a repression that's happening on the global scale and also in Palestine. Okay, so also yesterday, the EU affirmed the right to BDS, which is really exciting. So the EU, Mogherini stated that the EU stands firm in protecting freedom of expression, blah, 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 and including with regard to BDS. That's really exciting. That sets a huge precedent and can also be used, you know, hopefully in future lobbying and whatever activity, you know, you all decide to do. Okay, so what's happening on the federal level? There are two laws that have been passed and one bill that's currently still relevant with regards to BDS repression on the federal level. The first one is the Defending Public Safety Employees Retirement Act. And in it, there's a provision on a principal trade negotiating objective to discourage BDS. So that's one important bill, important law that you all should be aware of. The second one is the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act of 2015. In it, there's a provision that establishes a presidential report to Congress on BDS. That was passed in February. Obama issued a signing statement saying the law wouldn't apply to settlements, but signing statements have no teeth, so it doesn't really matter. This is unfortunate. The third one, and most troubling, is the Combating BDS Act of 2016. And it authorizes state and local governments to divest from entities that support BDS. But one important thing to know about this is that it's unconstitutional. Congress cannot authorize states to violate the First Amendment, which is what these state-level anti-BDS do. Anti-BDS bills do is they violate the First Amendment. So we are worried about this. It's currently, as an amendment, it's been put as an amendment into the Foreign Operations Bill, and it also is still alive as a standalone bill. Luckily, government gridlock is working in our favor this year, so we'll keep an eye on that. Okay, I also wanted to just jump to U.S. campuses. I'm not just talking about state-level stuff. I also want to mention other instances of repression. So if you are an activist in Boston, I'm sure you have been privy to the various instances of repression on U.S. campuses. When I was an undergrad at Northeastern, we went through quite a bit of stuff with repression. And then just, I think, last week on Tufts campus, there were posters put on across the campus that had pictures and names of students and professors who were active in SJP, calling them terrorists, blah, blah, essentially. And the David Horowitz Freedom Center is behind those posters. And those posters have also proliferated in San Francisco, in California, all across the country. David Horowitz got these names from a website called Canary Mission. And Canary Mission is a racist, McCarthyite website that started a year or so ago, and it has now over 400 students and professors' profiles on them who support Palestinian rights. And it's with the express purpose of preventing them from getting jobs or hurting their careers. It's a really awful website, but I recommend that you don't check out Canary Mission, you check out Against Canary Mission, which is why I put that up there, which is a great initiative from, I think, over 100 professors across the U.S. who are fighting back against this repression. Yeah, so check out that website. I also just wanted to mention two recent instances of faculty repression. Dr. Rabab Abdahadi, who's at San Francisco State University, also was, her face was plastered on these posters. She's a Palestinian professor, saying that she's a terrorist, has ties to Hamas, whatever. And Dr. Steven Salida, who, if you don't know about his case, I would highly recommend you check it out. I want to mention that these are both Palestinian professors, and often, as is the case with many issues, those who are most vulnerable are Palestinians and people of color, queer folk, trans folk, when they're doing this work. That's just something to be aware of. And then, of course, there are the academic associations, American Studies associations, et cetera, that have passed pro-BDS resolutions, which is wonderful. But there are a number of frivolous lawsuits that are currently standing against these academic associations because of their pro-BDS stances. So is this repression working? I think it's important to look towards what the opposition is saying about it. And this is an article that actually Nadia pointed me to a few days ago, where the president of the Louis Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law said, "We are now at a point where, sad to say, the BDS movement has saturated the country to the extent that it is no longer so predictable. You can no longer focus on a discrete number of campuses." And then the second quote is, "Part of the idea behind moving the battleground to state legislatures is to find more favorable turf for the anti-BDS message." So there is a pretty big push from campuses to state legislatures because of this. And then I also just wanted to mention, we can't not mention, the churches and unions that support BDS and are doing a great job. And then also with the United Electrical Workers Union, there was a frivolous lawsuit against them, but it didn't go anywhere. So that's exciting. All right, so state-level anti-BDS bills. Unfortunately, they have passed in 12 states so far, including New York, which was an executive order. And what's important to note about New York, it's the first executive order of its kind, hopefully the last, but Governor Cuomo, passed this executive order a mere week before the legislature was set to close, which indicates there were two anti-BDS bills still languishing in the state legislature. And this indicates to us that those bills were not going to pass. So he took an unconstitutional step and passed this executive order, but we're including it anyway. So the substance of these bills is that initially, you know, two or so years ago when they first started popping up in state legislatures, they were targeting universities, defunding universities that passed divestment resolutions. And that didn't go very far. And now they're a little bit more complicated, and they are divesting or boycotting or blacklisting entities that support BDS from pension, annuity funds, state contracts, state funds. And what's also important to note is that a lot of these bills are already folded into existing anti-discrimination bills. And as Nadia stated before, BDS does not violate anti-discrimination laws. BDS is trying to end discrimination, right? But there's a disconnect between the intent and the wording of the bills, which is it's important to still fight against these bills when they're folded into already existing anti-discrimination laws. So there are a few state-level wins, which is exciting, in Wisconsin, Maryland, California, Delaware, Ohio, Massachusetts, sort of. Hopefully that momentum will keep going. New York and Virginia. And then I also wanted to mention this initiative called Governors Against United Against BDS. There are now over 30 governors who have signed this initiative. It's an American Jewish Council initiative. We don't really know if it's innocuous or not. It sort of appeared at the same time that Cuomo signed his executive order, so we were really scared that this meant that. It's in your packet. Okay, great. So it's in your packet. We were scared that this was going to mean that more governors were going to sign executive orders. But so far that hasn't really been the case. These are just a picture of the governors that have signed. Massachusetts, your governor has signed. There have been some wins on the local level, which is also really exciting, both in Delaware and Woodstock. But of course there are some anti-BDS bills and resolutions that have proliferated on the local level as well. So who's behind the bills? This is a really good question that we are always trying to figure out. So the Israeli-American Council, the Chabad-Lubavitch Hasidic sect, Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, which is a Christian Zionist organization, the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, Israel, obviously, and other groups.
And that is our program this morning. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you. This little boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glucksberg, and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Rest in peace this week. One of Britain's greatest peace campaigners and researcher, Fran Scott, passed away at the weekend. This week we're reminded just how deep into Europe and America's cultural life the warfare state has penetrated, with the untimely death of one of the Western world's greatest unrecognised anti-war researchers and activist, a co-founder of the London-based Reinvestigate 9/11 website and campaigner, Fran Scott. Hackney-based Fran was only 58 when she died last Saturday of stomach and liver cancer, only 2 weeks after being diagnosed. She was terribly let down by the overstretched East London Health Service. One of the ambulance paramedics, on one of her attempts to get diagnosed and treated, told her East London hospitals just can't cope. The health service is now a postcode lottery. Fran hadn't been in the greatest of health, having hyperglycemia on and off for over a decade, but it wasn't as if Fran hadn't been bringing her more recent digestive problems to her GP's attention. But she kept being told she had indigestion and was given painkillers and constipation medicine. Doctors now say she had an aggressive form of stomach cancer since early this year. On the 29th of August, she was taken more seriously ill and the paramedic told her to go straight to A&E. From that day, at the end of August, Fran wasn't able to eat anything. She went twice, including by ambulance to accident and emergency at London's Homerton Hospital, but she was given more constipation medicine, which she couldn't eat, and sent home. She was finally admitted to Homerton for tests after she hadn't been able to eat for over 5 weeks. Anyway, her memorial will take place in Hackney on Tuesday, the 15th of November. Despite her many brilliant investigations into the crimes behind the war on terror, not a single mainstream media outlet has ever asked her for an interview or used her brilliant work exposing the crimes and the criminals driving this war machine. So tonight's second hour is dedicated to Fran Scott and her memory as one of the kindest, most intelligent and incisive citizen journalists we ever had the pleasure to meet. Sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, the DeLorean scandal and the sell-off of Britain's defence evaluation and research agency to Kinetic, owned by the Carlyle Group and the Bush crime family. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Well, we'll be coming to Fran in a minute, Martin. But first, the arc tonight is Vanessa Beely from Syria in Bristol City Centre. And she's done a lot of investigations into the Syrian civil war, some call it. Others say it's an intervention from outside.
Well, obviously, she's not Syrian. I don't know if... I think she may be...
She's not Syrian. I think she's British, but she's spent a long time in Syria.
Oh, yeah, she's done... If people look her up on the internet, they will see some very well-researched articles by her, in particular, just at random to point out, analysing the so-called white helmets, who are basically a propagandistic outfit pretending to be a humanitarian outfit. And guess what, folks? You're funding them. The British taxpayer and the other European and US taxpayers.
I mean, I've seen these white helmets. They are going around helping people, that's for sure.
Well, no, they're making videos.
Well, yes. Not no, yes.
No, they're making videos of themselves going... Do you know what? They only operate in areas controlled... In Aleppo, for example, controlled by Al-Qaeda. And they're actually embedded with Al-Qaeda. What? And they're actually... actually set up by a guy called James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British Army officer based in Turkey. And the money they all get, so what happens is the British taxpayer gives James Le Mesurier money. He then transmits it to the White Helmets, who have a media centre in East Aleppo, funded by us, which then only operates in East Aleppo and runs around showing pictures, for example, of that boy in the ambulance who wasn't injured at all, in fact, but it was then sent around the world and say, well, isn't it terrible these children are being killed? This is all manipulation. And Vanessa Beely's done some very good research. If people go and check it on the internet, they will see that she's done some very thorough...
No, don't go and check it on the internet, folks. Go down to Broad Street tonight.
She starts talking about half past seven
this evening. Yeah. And you can go meet her and ask her.
Well, yeah, they'll be on soon after we come off air.
I think it's the Arc Bar at the bottom on the left-hand side of Broad Street that she's speaking. But look, more about Syria tonight. Rebel food groups, we hear, Martin, are fighting each other now in Syria's Aleppo.
Well, that's possibly because of the pressure that's been put on the Americans by the Russians to separate Al-Qaeda from, which is Al-Nusra Front, from the so-called moderate rebels. But in actual fact, all of these groups have been feuding with each other all the way. All of them are supported directly or indirectly by outside powers, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the MIT in Turkey, our own glorious MI6 and CIA.
Well, you mentioned Turkey a few times now. Iraqi Prime Minister today has threatened war over Turkish military build-up in the north of Iraq.
Yeah, because they want to... What's happening is both Iraq and Syria are under threat of being partitioned by outside powers. And, of course, there's a general possibility of a major war breaking out here, which will draw in NATO, Russia and possibly China, because the Chinese have also sent military advisers to support the Syrian government. And there's also Egyptian military officers operating with the Russians inside Syria. So it's all very messy.
Isn't that what the Yinon plan called for? A lot of mess in that region?
Indeed, the Yinon plan, which was put together by the Israelis in the 1980s, sought to balkanise, in other words, to partition the surrounding countries into ethnic states. And the rationale for that was, if we've got different ethnic states, a Sunni state here, a Shia state there, a Druze state there, then the Jewish state then becomes the norm, you know, ethnically based states. Now, of course, Syria is not an ethnically based state. It's a secular republic in which all minorities and majorities are represented. So when the RAF and the other NATO forces bombed Deir ez-Zor the other week and killed 60 to 80 Syrian soldiers, I saw where the religious affiliations of the Syrian soldiers that were killed, and it was a cross-section of Syrian society. About 60% of them were Sunnis, 30% of them were Shia, and 10% of them were Christian. And the Syrian Arab Army is a multi-ethnic army. Completely. But the people they're fighting are not.
Also, of course, I say of course, but this is something I've only just come across, is this Benjamin Netanyahu book from the early 1980s, Terrorism, How the West Can Win. So, I mean, he's actually edited a book back in the 1980s explaining how states can use terrorism.
Well, what's interesting that happened recently is Jenny Tung, who's a liberal peer, has been kicked out of the Liberal Party because she was at some meeting in where the Israeli state were compared to Islamic State. And she was therefore accused of being anti-Semitic for going to this meeting. But in actual fact, we've got evidence that we've even got senior Israeli generals saying that they want Islamic State to succeed in overthrowing Assad. And we've also got evidence that they've been bringing jihadi wounded from Syria into Israel for treatment and then putting them back into the battle.
Let's get to the heart of the matter, actually, because the main problem with terrorism is they're seen as out-of-state actors, and yet we've got increasing masses and masses of evidence that states are actually sponsoring these terrorists, supplying them with arms, supplying them with intelligence, supplying them even with recruits. For example, the whole business of the hideous story of Khadija Sultan, the young London Asian school child who was trafficked, basically, by Canadian intelligence down into to work for ISIS. So these are not... Many of these terrorists are not non-state actors, they are just covert units for our own military.
Indeed. And, of course, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, Al-Sham have been working with MI6 since the 1980s. They're all SAS trained. And that's one of the things we've got to get people to realise. The terrorists are us. We are the terrorists.
Well, actually,
or not us, our government.
One of the news stories this week, which I did have to smile at, was that Nosy Parker, who's the head of MI5,
I think
you might know his proper name, Andrew Parker, he was promoted after the 7/7 London bombings, as he was one of the people responsible for that. UK spy chief sees growing threat from Russian cyber attacks. A big story this week, all over the press. Of course, this isn't the first time we've heard about this. Hillary Clinton at the American Legion was saying, we've got to watch out for the Russians doing cyber attacks on us, and Jan Stoltenberg, the UN Secretary General, just after the Bilderberg meeting. One would even suspect that that was something he was told to say by the Bilderbergers and Henry Kissinger and people like that. So it does look, I mean, you can almost gaze into a crystal ball. When there is a cyber attack, we are being basically told we've got to blame the Russians, even though, of course, that cyber attack could come from the NSA, it could come from anywhere.
Since they're supporting Al-Qaeda, they're quite capable of carrying out cyber attacks, aren't they? There's actually a very interesting programme by John Pilger on Russia Today, interviewing Julian Assange this week, where Assange categorically states that the information they've got did not come from the Russians. And, of course, the information they've got on Hillary Clinton's bad behaviour has come from people inside the United States.
Why haven't we heard this on Newsnight, then?
Because Newsnight's a propaganda organ. No more and no less. I mean, what happens is what some people call propaganda. In other words, we get told what things to care about and what things not to care about.
And what about the March 2017 coming crash? Well, this is something I'm increasingly convinced is going to happen. Vince Cable this week has been saying, once the Article 50 letter goes in, when Britain formally begins the process to leave the European Union, that the global capitalists, the likes of Goldman Sachs, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, etc., will crash the British economy. There'll basically be an economic warfare against Britain. And it's not just Vince Cable that's suggesting this. It's also Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's spin doctor, who, of course, is also very, very close to these war criminals. He has said also that there will be this attack on the British currency as soon as that letter goes in.
Well, I think what Campbell and Cable are suggesting is that Brexit will be the cause of the crash. So what you're saying is that this will be an attack by the global banking elite on Britain. I think there's going to be a crash, and it won't just be Britain. When Deutsche Bank goes down, as it is going to, whether because of Brexit or anything else, then it's going to pull everything down and not just Britain.
Also, UK domestic terror attacks, Martin. Migrants going to cause them or NATO? We've heard Sybil Edmonds in the US, former FBI translator, talking about this thing called Gladio B. Just run us through that, because it does look as if this migrant crisis is actually the long game here is to have terrorist attacks in Britain carried out by fascists, carried out by NATO, then blamed on the migrants.
Indeed.
That could actually start a race war, couldn't it?
It could, and of course that's exactly what's happening in various parts of the world. In France, for example, where the Front National may win the election on the back of all of this, we are being forced to confront divide and rule. But the fact of the matter is, overwhelmingly, I think Syria shows that the relationship between Western intelligence services and jihadi terrorists, fundamentally from Saudi Arabia and funded by Saudi Arabia, is ongoing. It started in the 1970s and is still going on today. And therefore, most of the attacks that took place, for example, in Nice, in Brussels, the first suspect has got to be our own intelligence.
Well, what evidence do you have that in Nice and Brussels and Paris?
Well, if we're going to go into the detail of it,
well, let's have a little bit at least.
Well, let's go. We could go to the details of each of those cases. We could go through, for example, in Nice, the CCTV footage of the truck crashing into the people. The intelligence services wanted the local police to wipe the CCTV.
They ordered them to wipe the CCTV. The FBI had been following the guy from the United States. Yeah. Goodness knows what they're doing in France for the month previously.
Yes. Well, in other words, these people are either put up to it. Or in many cases don't even exist. There's a question about whether any hijackers hijacked planes on 9/11. They're not on the passenger manifests of any of the planes, and the head of the FBI at the time said, yes, but they use false identities. Well, how do you know who they are then if they use false identities? And several people people that they blamed were on the BBC and in the Daily Telegraph saying, hang on a minute, we're not dead and we didn't do it. That was reported, but it was forgotten.
Well, this is a subject that Fran Scott was very close to her heart, and I thought we'd start our little tribute this evening with a clip from her speaking about the September the 11th attacks, and I spoke to her on the Dialect Show, which goes out every Tuesday lunchtime, here, just on the 7th of September we recorded this, which is only, you know, sort of whilst she was actually very sick. She hadn't been eating for a day, well, anyway, I didn't know at the time, but here she goes into some real detail about this most, one of the most recent things, Martin, which is the 28 pages, the released 28 pages.
Yes, and what they showed was that the Saudis had some role in the attack. Well, we know that, but the Saudis are also working with the Israelis. There's a Saudi-Israeli connection, and they weren't the only people involved.
So let's hear from Fran Scott now, talking to me just literally back in the beginning of September.
The latest that's come out is, as I said, thanks to former Democratic Senator Bob Graham, who sat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he was also on the 9/11 Commission. And he's been a key critic of the official investigation into 9/11, and he's fought for many years to have a declassified chapter of the 9/11 report and of additional materials relating to 9/11 to be released to the public domain. It was released in, I believe, July this year, July the 15th, 2016. They released the declassified 28 pages, but with 97 redactions in it. You know, so it's far from what people want, because people don't want the redactions. They want to see what is redacted. Mr. Graham characterised the FBI as moving, I'm quoting him, beyond a cover-up to an aggressive deception in which they rewrote the narrative for the 9/11 attacks. Now, that's quite a strong criticism of the official version of events.
So what came out in these 28 pages we didn't already know?
It showed a web of links to Saudi government officials, Saudi royal family members, and suspected Saudi intelligence operatives that were within the US at the time, and the 9/11 hijackers. On page one, it shows links to the Saudi Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador to the United States. He made payments to a supporter of Osama bin Laden. This supporter of Osama bin Laden boasted of helping the two Flight 77 hijackers in San Diego. And in a phone book of an al-Qaeda associate, Abu Zubaydah, there was a phone number linked to Prince Bandar and a phone number for a bodyguard at the Saudi embassy in Washington who was under FBI investigation. And very crucially, the FBI never showed up to interview a top 9/11 suspect. An FBI assessment has been mentioned in the 28 pages of a Saudi national, Omar al-Bayoumi, as a likely intelligence officer for Riyadh, who facilitated support, including flight training, for at least two of the 19 hijackers living in San Diego. And Bayoumi left the US in the summer of 2001, and he went to Birmingham in England, where he was taken into custody after 9/11 at the FBI's requests. But the UK couldn't hold him for more than a certain amount of days by law, and the FBI never showed up to interview Bayoumi, yet he was a key suspect. And during that time, he was released from custody and left for Saudi Arabia. So this is a clear negligence by the FBI there, a chief suspect, and they've let him go.
Tragic, Martin, isn't it, really, that Fran hasn't received more recognition for this? Is it really important work that she's doing? Why are we hearing this from us here now, from Fran, and not from the mainstream press? Because they should be doing this work, not citizen journalists in London.
Well, carry out a thought experiment. If 9/11 was an inside job, which I believe and many people do, then they don't just leave it to chance who gets to report about what happens in relationship to it. The purpose of doing it, if you are the intelligence services behind it, is to try and bamboozle people into wars on Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, etc. So, of course, you've got to make sure that you control the mainstream narrative about the event having carried it out.
But this is
otherwise
Senator,
there would be no point carrying
it out. This is Senator Bob Graham, you know, a serious senior politician in the US, is calling the 9/11 Commission report an aggressive deception.
Well, I mean, the head of
why
the,
isn't that reported?
The head, but I mean, he's an ex-senator, of course. But of course, even the actual head of the 9/11 Commission, whose name now escapes me, said we never got proper cooperation. Don't forget, they never wanted to have an inquiry at all. And to be honest with you, I think the 9/11 inquiry was basically a whitewash. There is evidence to suggest that the planes weren't hijacked by hijackers, but they were in fact taken over from the ground by Global Hawk technology, which has been in existence since the 1970s. Much more straightforward to explain planes being crashed into buildings if it's being flown from the ground rather than by so-called people who've been training to fly light aircraft.
Before we leave 9/11, Christopher Bolin, Anthony Hall, etc., point the finger at these Israelis, mostly actually joint US-Israeli citizens who have got into the very powerful positions in the US.
That's right, and I think the my best guess of who was behind it is the true axis of evil, which is Israel, the CIA and MI6, but also, of course, that includes the Saudis. The Saudis and the Israelis are allies in the Middle East. You wouldn't think that, would you, from mainstream media, but everybody knows that they're on the same side in Syria, for example.
And it wasn't just the 9/11 attacks that Fran looked into. She also did some sterling work on the London bombings, the 7/7 bombings, going to the heart of the matter by getting to have a really close look at where these alleged bombers came from Leeds, from the ICRA bookshop, where the two main people, it seemed, who were in charge of that raid on London, Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shahzad Tanweer, were at something called the ICRA bookshop. And it seems that it hasn't been really much attention paid to this place, because this is where they both were, and this is where both of those two were going on terrorist training exercises of various sorts. But what Fran brought out was the most astonishing fact for me, was that actually it was British Special Forces that were training them.
Indeed, it was an ex-British Special Boat Squadron guy who supposedly converted to Islam, who then recruited these guys and basically set them up as patsies. That's what it looks like.
OK, so let's have a listen to Fran talking about that now, that last year on this show. I'm also joined by Fran Anderson. Hi, Fran, who knows a bit about Mohammed Siddiqui Khan.
Hi there, Tony. Yes, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and Shahzad Tanweer, two of the alleged bombers, were trustees of the ICRA charity bookshop and youth outreach in Leeds. This was a centre distributing extremist Islamic media, and the man running ICRA was Martin McDade, an ex-special boat service soldier. He supposedly converted to Islam, and Newsnight reported that a youth worker at ICRA called Mark Hargreaves says that McDade had a hidden agenda, as he was deliberately grooming young Muslim men and was espousing the most extremist Muslim agenda.
So there you go, special boat service. When you say that they were patsies, Martin, that implies that you don't think maybe that they didn't actually do it at all.
Well, all I'm saying, the way this stuff works is that the Al-Qaeda networks, the jihadi networks, are staffed by, at the lower levels, are staffed by a lot of people who've generally had chaotic lives, trouble with the law, drug and alcohol problems. They become Muslims, they've got some Muslim background, but the masterminds behind it all are ensconced within the intelligence structure in Saudi Arabia, in Britain, in America and in Israel. They are coordinating all of it. They certainly and I think what's happened in Syria over the last 3 years should make the scales drop from anybody's eyes. It's absolutely clear that NATO intelligence services are working hand in glove with jihadi terrorists inside Syria.
There is this grey area, isn't there, between infiltrating a terrorist group and controlling a terrorist group, that the intelligence services seem to be blurring that line.
Well, if you look at the history of Gladio, and anybody can look this up on the internet, the purpose of Gladio in the post-war years in Western Europe was to basically work with the grain of existing social fractures. So they're all the terrorist groups in Italy in the 70s and 80s, the Red Brigades on the left, Prima Linea and Nuclei Armati Proletari, and also fascist groups were all being run by SISMI, the Italian
just look up Operation Gladio. You can find loads and loads about that online. But look, the other thing, of course, is as Special Boat Service, SBS or whatever, SAS, etc., MI5, MI6, these all classed as special forces, and they are actually outside the purview of Parliament. Even the Intelligence and Security Committee has no scrutiny of them.
No, indeed, and the SAS and others are operating now inside Syria on the basis of no legal basis whatsoever. Can you imagine what the British would do if there were Syrian special forces operating in Britain, casing joints, deciding things to blow up? Because don't forget, we killed the RAF killed 80 Syrian soldiers less than a few weeks ago. And if the Syrians were so minded, they might decide to kill maybe a few of our soldiers. And they would be within their rights to do so in one interpretation. Wouldn't they?
Anyway, Fran Scott turned herself to many different and actually some complicated scientific investigations. One of her most recent was on the anthrax attacks in New York and Washington at the time of the 9/11 attacks. Now, Martin, these were really important because what they did is they paralysed parts of the democratic system where the senators, the congressmen, etc., could and should have been actually finding out what was really going on 9/11.
Yes, and if you look who got the anthrax, it was all the liberal senators who were likely to vote against the Patriot Act.
Anyway, let's listen to really a kind of magnum opus here from Fran Scott, where she actually wanted to write a book about this as well before she died a couple of just last Saturday. So this was a talk that she gave just literally back in May this year, all about the anthrax and the anthrax attacks on September the 11th.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for spending your money to come here and taking your time to come here and speak to the speakers. You're all appreciated, every one of you. Without you, these events could not happen. So anyway, on to the talk. I'm going to be talking about the Amerifrax, which is the 9/11 anthrax attacks. And just in case people are not quite sure what anthrax is, it's a bacillus that's in the soil, and it usually is a threat to livestock, and human beings get infected with contact from a diseased animal, and it's very rare in the natural world, thank God. But however, if it's weaponized, then it becomes much more lethal, and they can process it into very fine powder with 1 to 20 microns in diameter, which is just minuscule. And if it enters the lungs, which is the pulmonary form of anthrax disease, that's the most lethal form of the disease, and that is relevant to the 9/11 anthrax attacks. So what are we talking about when we're talking about the 9/11 anthrax attacks? Well, there were two waves of these attacks. They were spores that were sent in letters. The first lot of letters were sent to the mainstream media. Most of the offices were in New York, except for one that was in Florida. And they were all postmarked 18th of September 2001 from Trenton, New Jersey. And then the second wave of letters that contained anthrax spores were sent to two Democrat senators, Thomas Dassley and Patrick Leahy. And the same postmark, Trenton, New Jersey, but the 9th of October 2001. Now, the second wave of letters were extremely, highly sophisticated weaponized anthrax, as if the first wave wasn't, it was, but the second wave even more. Congress and the other government buildings had to be closed because they were contaminated with these spores. It caused massive disruption to the postal service because likewise they could have been contaminated with these spores. And the decontamination cost was over $1 billion. So it was a quite significant event. And 22 people were infected and 5 people unfortunately died. So this is a crime that's been committed, and there should be what's called a standard investigation procedure that should have been carried out, which means who has the means to carry this out? So the skills, the equipment, the money, the knowledge. Who has the method to carry this out, the procedure or the set plan, etc.? And who has the motivation? So that's a reason for committing the crime, the belief system that motivates them to do this crime. And also opportunity to actually commit the crime as well. And most importantly, facts should not be made to fit a already predetermined theory. Facts should be gathered up, and a theory should be extrapolated from the facts. And the theories have to be tested by the facts. Now, did the FBI follow up this SIP, Standard Investigation Procedure? I don't think so. So I'm going to show you why I don't think so. First of all, the FBI's first theory was that Iraq and Al-Qaeda did it. Iraq was the sponsor of the 9/11 anthrax spores, and Al-Qaeda were the people that carried it out. And a senior FBI official says that the Bush administration was heavily pressurising them to put the blame on Iraq, because they were so desperate, the Bush administration was so desperate to have a case for going to war. So this is a typical strategy of tension that we know about, which is a phrase that Daniela Ganser very sensibly have given us in his look on terrorist incidents. So the idea is to make people so afraid that they're going to give up their freedom for security. So between September the 11th and the 3rd of October 2001, the media was saying expect anthrax bioterrorism from the same source as 9/11. So the media and the Bush administration and the FBI were saying all this. And they said if we attack Iraq, we'll have a good chance of bioweapons attacks. So how did they know that we were going to have these anthrax attacks? On what intelligence are they telling us, warning us this? And why can't we see this intelligence that they supposedly had? So anyway, let's have a look at the 9/11 hijacker connection. The Centre for Civilian Biodefence Strategies examined this, and they've come across this this fact that the 9/11 hijacker Ahmed al-Haznawi attended a Florida hospital with a dark lesion on his leg, which was consistent with cutaneous anthrax. So that's not proof, but it's a possibility of a link between one of the hijackers and anthrax. And some of the 9/11 hijackers actually attended a Florida flight school, which was very near one of the workplaces, the American media workplace, which had one of the first victims of the anthrax attacks. So when we look at Mohammed Atta, this is very interesting. He's the 9/11 lead hijacker, supposedly. In June 2000, he went into the USDA, US Department of Agriculture, and asked for a loan for crop dusting equipment. And he made it quite obvious who he was. He brought attention onto himself almost deliberately. He was a very angry person, and he was shouting a lot. He said, make sure you spelt my name right. He even pointed to a picture of the Twin Towers that was behind the woman's desk and said, they're coming down. He even talked about how he admired Osama bin Laden and how he wanted to learn to fly. So why was he so keen to draw attention onto himself? I mean, it's a bit strange, isn't it? Because surely if he was one of the culprits, the least thing he wants to do is bring attention to himself. The 9/11 Commission totally ignored this particular incident. So in February 2002, Colin Powell makes the case for war with Iraq by holding up a simulated test tube of anthrax spores. So that's him making the case for war and saying Iraq was the culprit for the 9/11 anthrax attacks. Well, the first theory of the FBI starts unravelling because, well, for a start, ABC News keeps reporting that Fort Detrick is stating that Amerifrax contains bentonite. Bentonite, they say, is to do with the Iraq biowarfare program. Now, bentonite was in the Iraq biowarfare program, but that had been discontinued well before 2001. However, in 2007, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology actually proved that there was no bentonite in the spores. So Amerifrax was not caused, you know, the culprit was not Iraq. The FBI were forced to admit that 9/11 anthrax had to have come from a US biowarfare laboratory because what you add to the anthrax spores is its DNA, is its signature, and it gives you a clue where the origin of the spores came from. A silicone tin signature was discovered in the 9/11 anthrax spores, and that has long been used by US laboratories. So it's quite clear that the FBI did not follow up the standard investigation procedure. They were trying to get the facts to fit a predetermined theory that Iraq was the culprit and Al-Qaeda was the culprit. So we had a lot of media propaganda in the West, particularly America, of course. Very interesting to see the mainstream media not doing its job properly and asking the awkward questions that it should have been. Between September 2001 to 2003, the media link Iraq and Al-Qaeda to the anthrax attacks over 500 times. And they all quote from the same unnamed intelligence source. How convenient, and they don't even question this source. And they're hoping to repeat it enough times people are going to believe it. When the ABC News reporter Brian Ross was confronted about spreading false connections between Iraq and anthrax letters, he just brushed it off as an inconsequential error. But I don't think Iraqi citizens will think it was an inconsequential error. So the second theory that the FBI came across, well, construct, they said, well, it has to be a lone individual that created the anthrax spores. And they claimed that you could do it for as little as $2,500 using readily available laboratory equipment from various stores. However, this was proved to be absolutely ridiculous because Amerifrax is an aerosoled form which demands very sophisticated, very advanced knowledge, training and equipment. You could not buy it from any department store and cobble together some kind of way of constructing this. So the first suspects that they picked on were some doctors. Stephen Hatfield in particular sued for $5.8 million in damages in one. So they were really desperate to find a lone person that they could scapegoat for this. The FBI and the Bush administration, interestingly enough at this time, drop all mention of Amerifrax linked to the 9/11 hijackers. Why? Because it didn't fit the lone nut theory anymore, and yet it was an important clue in the investigation, but they drop it as soon as it didn't fit their pet theory. So the scapegoat they picked on was Dr. Bruce Ivins, because he had a little bit of mental instability, supposedly. He was the sole suspect, and he worked at Fort Detrick in Maryland, which is the USAMRID, US Army Military Research and Investigation Department. And he supposedly kills himself with an overdose of codeine and Tylenol in August 2008. And that's convenient for the FBI because they close the case. February the 19th, 2010, they close the case on who did the 9/11 anthrax attacks. And they never had to prove their case in court. Very convenient. So let's go back to the actual anthrax spores of 9/11. They're the Ames strain. And in nature, it was isolated from a cow in Texas in 1980. And it was sent to USAMRIID, that's Fort Detrick, and to 15 other US laboratories in three other countries. You've got at least four variants of the Ames strain. The 9/11 Ames strain is a clue as to, you know, where it came from, where it originated, who the suspects might be. It's highly toxic, it's very lethal.
it's concentrated and it's very, very rare. The spores differ from all from the AIM strain. The senator's letters had an extra fine powder that literally just floats out the envelope. Not like that. That's talcum powder. If that was anthrax, that would have gone spreading all over this building and it would be contaminated and we would have to take ciprofloxacin or something. So the spores were extremely small. So let's go back to the anthrax letters for a little bit. The three that are very interesting are the only ones that the FBI has released to the public, and we have to ask, why aren't they releasing the other anthrax letters? What are they hiding? So the ones they've released to the public are the two from the to the senators, Senator Dastley, MBC Doc Tom Brocco from New York Post. And as you can see, the writing is the same, the date is the same, and it looks like somebody's trying to make it look like they're kind of illiterate Muslims, because it says take penicillin now, which is misspelt. Anar is great, death to Israel, death to America, we have the anthrax, you cannot stop us. I mean, it sounds like a bit too convenient script here, really. But they're obviously trying to link it to the 9/11 hijackers. Maybe that's why they don't want to release the other letters, because they dropped the link to the 9/11 hijackers once they took up the lone nut theory. So why the two senators? Well, very interesting. Congress was debating the Patriot Act, which the Bush administration wanted to pass after 2001. And so Congress was a target. Bush wanted the Patriot Act to be passed before the 9/11 shock wore off. The Senate had a Democratic majority at the time, and Patrick Dastley, he was the Senate Majority Leader, and he decides on when a bill is discussed and when a bill is going to be voted on. And Thomas Leahy is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and looks at any bill and the effects it may have on civil liberties, which, of course, the Patriot Act had a massive impact on civil liberties. It was a massive erosion on civil liberties. So all they were doing was their usual congressional scrutiny, but for the Bush administration, that wasn't good enough. They were too slow, and they were being blamed for slowing up the Patriot Act and somehow being unpatriotic. The question to ask us is, how could the 9/11 hijackers have the ability to have seen into the future and knowing that they should be targeting those two senators? So the FBI's second theory of the lone nut starts to collapse only in 2011, really. Four reports discredit the FBI. As you see, they're listed here. Lawrence Livermore, Sandia National Laboratories, the Government Accountability Office, National Academy of Sciences. The FBI did not use the newest methods, which could have proved or disproved where the spores came from. And the letters, as for Ivins' flask, they couldn't prove a link from Dr. Ivins to the crime. And it's quite clear that the second theory did not follow the standard investigation procedure. And a very interesting point to raise as well is this looks like somebody trying to deliberately destroy evidence here, because the anthrax archive was destroyed, and that was between October the 10th and the 11th, 2001. The FBI actually allowed Iowa State University, which had the anthrax archive, they allowed them to destroy this archive, and it had over 70 years of data with hundreds of files. And if that hadn't been destroyed, and that's between the Amerithrax AIMS and the strain in the collection would have shown. And it would have shown us when the bacteria was actually isolated, how widely it had been distributed. And genetic clues could have also identified the perpetrators. And scientists have quite rightly said that destroying this evidence was... this destroyed evidence was crucial for the investigation. So that sounds very suspicious. So, you know, reinvestigate Amerifrax. Yes, that's exactly what we need, you know. March 24th, 2010, attorney Barry Kissin writes a report to Congressman and physicist Russ Holt. And the committee are given documents with sections redacted. Why? Why were the sections redacted? And why can't we, the public, see what was being what was in these redacted documents about the anthrax attacks? And there is no evidence that you can manufacture a sufficient quantity of spores from Fort Detrick, where Ivins worked. Absolutely no evidence. Russ Holt said the United States needs an independent review of the investigation. And I'd say they need to start by using the standard investigation procedure, which they should have done from the beginning. So what are, who could be the other Amerifrax suspects? Well, I'd like to raise the hypothesis that it could be what's called the deep state hypothesis. Since the 1990s, the CIA have been weaponizing anthrax. Between 2011 and 2012, scientific evidence shows that the silicone tin signature that was in the 9/11 anthrax, it's impossible for a single person to have manufactured that anthrax. It requires a laboratory with special expertise, not found at USAMRIID, which is Fort Detrick, but it is possible to manufacture that silicone tin signature used in the anthrax attacks on 9/11. It is possible at Dugway Laboratories, which is a US Army testing ground in Utah, and it is possible at Bethel Memorial Institute, Iowa, which works for the CIA and the US military with facilities for Amerifrax spores. The FBI ignored this. Why? Sounds like it was deliberate. And we also have evidence of CIA covert anthrax programs. A leaked report in 1999 where the CIA analysed a hypothetical anthrax attack via the mail with 2.5 grams, a maximum amount that could be posted without detection. The powder was a trillion spores per gram, and the senator's letters, 2 grams, and the same spore concentration. Coincidence? Also, we've got Dark Winter Exercise, June 2001, where smallpox simulated attack was to be blamed on Iraq. Then we have Project Clear Vision to assess bioagent dissemination of bomblets. And that was closed down due to suspicions its findings could be used in covert US bioweapons programs. And then we have Project Bacchus, 1999 to 2000, to see if it was possible to build a bioweapons facility with off-the-shelf equipment, which was one of the claims the FBI had made over the 9/11 anthrax attacks and was proven to be ridiculous. We also have a whistleblower from the FBI. He actually was the head of the 9/11 anthrax attacks investigation, so he's really top level. He comes out of the woodwork on April the 8th, 2015. He says the FBI investigation was understaffed, it lacked bioterror forensic skills, there were no senior microbiologists, and they gathered a staggering amount of expulgatory evidence, that means showing that Ivins was completely innocent. This evidence still remains secret. So we have to ask why. Why are they keeping all this evidence secret? No fibres, no hair, no handwriting match with the letters and Dr. Bruce Ivins. Over 400 people had access to Ivins' flasks anyway, but we know that it didn't come from Fort Detrick where he worked. But that's been proven. So the deep state hypotheses, well, you know, what have we got to go on that the deep state or the shadow government exists in the US? Well, President Eisenhower warned us about it in his farewell speech in January 1961. He said, "We have to guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex, and that there could be a disastrous rise of misplaced power And then we've also got a Pentagon insider in 2011 saying continuing small wars or the threat thereof are essential for the MICC, the Military Industrial Congressional Complex. And we also have Michael Lofgren, who was a Congress staffer for 28 years. So this is an insider's knowledge here. He talks about a shadow government, the deep state, which rules America, consisting of intelligence, military, security, judiciary, corporations, and organized crime. And that this book was released in January 2016. I recommend reading it because he knows what he's talking about. So I think that that should have been part of an investigation into the 9/11 anthrax attacks. So the culprits, they had the deep state, they had the means, they had the method, they had the motivation, they had the opportunity. They were able to attempt to cover it up and destroy the evidence. And let's not forget that they also have the US government advisors, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Kissinger, are all disciples of Leo Strauss, who promotes a militant foreign policy aimed at regime change, and Machiavelli, who also says leaders should lie to the people to achieve their goals and to create disorder so that people crave order. So I'd say that the deep state, the shadow government, that there's a strong possibility that they exist. It's not saying that everybody in those fields are party to the deep state. No, of course not. Otherwise, we wouldn't have whistleblowers coming out of the woodwork and blowing the whistle. But the important thing is that it looks like it exists. And they lied then, and they're lying now on practically everything that's happening today. Thank you very much.
Well, that's the voice of Fran Scott, who passed away last Saturday at St. Joseph's Hospice in Hackney. Now, Martin, an absolutely brilliantly aimed presentation there. This is because the anthrax attacks were used to completely shut down the democratic process in the US just when they needed it most.
Indeed, and it was very suspicious that the anthrax was sent to people who were likely to vote against the so-called Patriot Act. But of course, the Patriot Act was a massive, massive document, and it had obviously been written long before 9/11, and it was passed without anybody reading it, giving the government massive powers beyond the Constitution. If people can't see what's wrong with this, then they need to take a step back and have a serious look at it.
Now, I mentioned just briefly at the top of the hour, actually, the privatisation of Defence Evaluation and Research Agency, the British agency. When that was privatised, and it was bought by the Carlyle Group, but eventually by the Bush crime family, by a company called Kinetic, this agency, all of it was privatised, apart from Porton Down, which is the biological and chemical weapons research part of it. And that, of course, was what the anthrax is. Now, this is incredibly sensitive and incredibly dangerous stuff. It seems almost everything apart from that is now going into the world of private profit, private gain.
Well, I think it's quite extraordinary that any military and intelligence function should be carried out by the private sector. You've now got millions of people in the US who are private employees of private companies who have security clearance
now,
and access to information. Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden, Booz Allen Hamilton. So these people are now doing work subcontracted by people like the CIA who are part of the official
state.
Yeah,
well, what's happened with the CIA is that it's just become a series of shell companies. There's masses and masses of these. I mean, we mentioned John Le Mesurier earlier. James Le Mesurier earlier, who's the ex-British military intelligence officer who's behind the white helmets in Syria. He basically was employed and trained by the British state, and then he sets up in business on his own, but he gets British taxpayers' money to run a psychological warfare operation on behalf of his paymasters. And of course, that once you've got private profit involved in any kind of military or intelligence matter, it starts to distort the whole thing, because people want more trouble so that they get more money to make more profits.
And of course, what's happening is these private businesses are using the cloak of national security to get on with their dirty work, making money from war.
Indeed. And of course, what the problem with that in the long run is that the nationalised Russian arms industry, where every ruble that they spend on weapons is a ruble they can't spend on hospitals, schools, etc., means that they actually get value for money from their armed forces, whereas we don't.
Something that hopefully Abby Wood up at Filton MOD Procurement might learn from that. But anyway, another story this week, just briefly. US personnel targeting killer drones from Britain. This is Jamie Doward in The Observer on Sunday. US military personnel serving at the UK's RAF bases are helping to identify targets for drone attacks according to their job specifications. Human rights groups seized on the descriptions of the roles as proof of the UK's part in the covert US drone programme, which some critics claim is in breach of international law. These jobs are being advertised at places like RAF Molesworth and some up at Menwith Hill in Yorkshire.
Well, the RAF drone that helped to kill the 80 Syrian soldiers at Deir ez-Zor the other week was flown from inside the UK. In other words, we're engaging in illegal actions abroad, assassinating people without due process, engaging in warfare without running it past Parliament, and ultimately, of course, you're playing with fire.
What about Leo Strauss, Fran mentioned there, this whole idea of order from chaos, that actually chaos, it may seem that they go into a war with a loose scenario, just wanting to sow chaos around the world.
Well, that's pretty much what's been going on. I mean, the Leo Strauss believed that that you should lie to the people in order to try and get them to do what they wouldn't do otherwise. And these techniques were pioneered by the Nazis in the 30s and are coming to fruition today.
So, Fran's memorials on Tuesday, 15th of November in Hackney. She was the web mistress of Reinvestigate 9/11 website, which is still very proudly sitting out there. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Green Councillor for Clifton, Paula O'Rourke. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Sister Show Dialects on noon every Tuesday. A page for your comments and complaints, if you've got them, is onewordthisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ralph Nader, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. Muckraker Jim Hightower said about Ralph Nader's new book, published by City Lights in San Francisco, "Breaking Through Power provides progressive boat rockers with inspiration and a plan for reclaiming America from the greedy plutocrats who think democracy is for sale to the highest bidder," end quote. Just 3 weeks before the 2016 presidential election, Nader presented his plan of how to create a populist movement. He said it needs to be specific in its goals: unite left and right, and take power on a national scale. This was an auspicious moment, because in the audience at City Lights Books that night were so many who felt frustrated that yet again they had to vote for the lesser of two evils, and only two again, not even three or four choices. These thoughts were clearly expressed among the waiting audience. We had all arrived an hour ahead of the start time to find a seat inside the popular small bookstore, and we had time to talk among ourselves. When Nader arrived and spoke, everybody turned very quiet. He explained how to take power ourselves and apply it directly to Congress without the mediation or intervention of any party. Congress, Nader said, is the Khyber Pass, the center of power. We need to focus razor-like on individual members. Organizing from the grassroots in each district, we agree on specific demands that are supported widely, even nationally, and then presented in person to these members. In part one of the talk, Nader gave examples for some such goals. Demand a living wage of $15 an hour. Audit the Pentagon. Reduce the military budget. Gather uncollected taxes to the tune of $400 billion. Initiate a Wall Street speculation tax. Demand the transformation from fossil fuels and nuclear to renewables. Expand direct democracy. Referenda and recall should be possible in all states. And these are just a few examples Ralph Nader gave in the first half of his book talk for Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. Nader's plan as to how we arrive at formulating these goals is equally specific. He suggests opening year-round offices in each congressional district to represent the people full-time. There would be about 2,000 people in these offices in each district, made up of volunteers and paid staff. In order for this to become a national movement, seed money is needed to get it going for the first 36 months, crossing one election in which recalcitrant members who refuse to vote according to the wishes of the people can be voted out or recalled. Even though the initial price tag for offices across the country could be $1 billion, that money can be donated by the known progressive billionaires. After 36 months, we can draw on people willing to donate a certain amount of hours and $200 to $300 per year, and the movement becomes self-sustaining. Nader's plan for breaking through power also includes a small staff of full-time lobbyists in Washington. They will follow up on the local demands, including offering sample legislation. They monitor success and failure by members of Congress to obey the wishes of their constituents. In the conclusion of Ralph Nader's first half on Breaking Through Power, he presented a third important element of direct democracy, the people's summons. Instead of patiently waiting for the Congress member to let us know when he or she is available for coffee and questions in the district, this new grassroots democratic movement, via their local offices, comes up with concrete demands and sends a polite summons to the Congress member to appear at a town hall meeting organized by the constituents and to be prepared to answer questions and take direction. Nader even has a plan how to break the media monopolies, referring to the Communications Act of 1934. That act codifies that the airways belong to the public and that broadcasters must earn a license to use them by serving the interest, convenience, and necessity of the American public. Currently, Congress has decided that the people have no access to their property and that the media monopolies are using the airwaves for free to make unspeakable profits. Nader began setting up the winning combination of people's summons and direct intervention with individual members to make sure our airwaves are no longer given away for free. I recorded Ralph Nader on October 18, 2016 at City Lights in San Francisco.
We're landlords. The FCC is our real estate agent. And they've made sure Congress says, you get it free. You turn that around. You say to Congress, no, no. No, no, little boys and girls. From now on, you're obeying us, the sovereign people. And we'll show you how we're going to enforce that with summons, formal summons for town meetings regularly. You report back to us. We control the town meetings. We're going to have the agenda. You're just going to listen and study and go back and do what you're told. because we have a left-right coalition, and we have the evidence and the humanity behind it. And so we should have our own audience network. Why don't we have 3 hours a day, prime time, where we charge them rent, and then all over the country, local, state, national, we have reporters, producers, modern production facilities, and with the cable stations. Listen to the giveaway on this. We have 650 cited cable channels in this country, each one more idiotic than the other. For a while, I'm told they had a chimp channel dressed up in clothes. I have nothing against chimps. I'm coming out with a fable next month called Animal Envy, which you may be interested in. And we don't have a channel. The chimps? I mean, this is going too far. Equal rights here, at least. Now notice, to show you how they control us by controlling our expectation levels. Once our expectation levels are down, crooked politicians, pox on both their houses, I got better things to do with my private life. Exactly what they want you to say. When you think politics is a dirty word, why are we surprised when we get dirty politics? Actually, it's a beautiful word if you go back to its derivation. And so here's what we do on the cable. How come we have no labor channel? We have no consumer channel. We have no channel for millions of students, college, community college students. We have no channel for accountants. They have a lot to answer for. We have no channel for people who view themselves as small taxpayers and are sick of paying the freight for the big freeloaders. We should have a channel for all kinds of groups. We got 650 channels. We give it all away with nothing by way of reciprocity. What's the doctrine of reciprocity, for heaven's sake? We give away all kinds of R&D that created the semiconductor industry, Silicon Valley, aerospace, half of the pharmaceutical industry, the nanotechnology, all taxpayer basic research, the genetic engineering out of National Institutes of Health over the years. What are we getting for it? Other than staggering drug prices? Out of the stupid Facebook accounts where they use our personal information free and don't pay for it? Billions of idiotic apps? You got all this modern technology, you still have people in horrible poverty, horrible hunger. 15 million children go hungry at night. Look at the hovels that people live in. Look at their shattered pensions by the Wall Street criminality, which shattered trillions of dollars of pensions, took away 9 million jobs in 2008-09, and then went to the taxpayer for a bailout as they jumped ship with golden handshakes, the big guys. None of them went to jail. None of them were prosecuted. You don't think that's a left-right position? Tough criminal, corporate criminal laws would be passed in Congress. Tough penalties. Whole new penitentiaries created with good food because they demand it. Defend and extend civil liberties. This is a real left-right. The Patriot Act is an atrocity. It allows the government to search your home or apartment and not tell you for 72 hours. It allows the government, without probable cause, to get into your medical, financial information, your library takeouts and loans, etc. You don't think that's a 90% thing? Left, right, libertarian, progressive, liberal, conservative? Of course it is. Expand civic skills and experience among students in elementary and high school. Let them learn how to defend themselves from the electronic child molesters and the marketeers. Let them learn how to choose important and good food and good drink and avoid going overweight and obese and diabetic at a young age, which is lethal. Get rid of corporate personhood. Get rid of this eminent domain where you take small private property and give it to the big guys for development. That's a left-right issue. Empower shareholders, mutual funds, pension funds. They own the majority of shares of the big corporations. They have no power. They don't control what they own. The bosses control. And they've rigged the SEC and other agencies to strip us of our power of ownership. These are not capitalists. Capitalists observe owners having some control over what they own. These are corporate capitalists building a corporate state, which Franklin Delano Roosevelt called the 1938 message to Congress, fascism. We have clinical fascism in this country. Rethink the war on drugs, criminal justice reform. Huge now, left-right. It's passing bills in juvenile justice in 15 legislatures now. These huge penalties for a little hard drug possession. Really update the real weapons of mass destruction threat and face it. And you know what it is? It's viruses and bacteria out of control worldwide. And we have minuscule budgets. The whole boondoggle missile defense system every year sucks you up $9 to $10 billion, and they've been at it since the Reagan administration. They can't show that it works. It can't work. They can't fight any decoy of an intercontinental ballistic missile. The main organization of physicists over 15 years ago condemned it. These are the physicists who often consult with the Pentagon. So they're going $9 to $10 billion. The Center for Disease Control budget, $6 billion. We could have epidemics, either generated here or abroad, mutating and take millions of lives. What are we doing building $13 billion aircraft carrier, more nuclear subs? We don't need them. We can blow up the world now in TNT equivalents 300 times and make the rubble bounce. But it's big business for the military-industrial complex. And then the other one is prioritize the protection of the environment. Here's another misconception. You know, all these right-wing people around the country, you know, they listen to Rush Limbaugh, they believe Sean Hannity. I mean, you know, what are they, living in an illusion here? Of course they're not going to support environmental protection when it's at an abstract level, pointy-headed bureaucrats telling you how to run your affairs. Then you say, do you have kids? Yeah. Do you want them to breathe dirty air? Huh? Eat unsafe food? Have dangerous medicines? That's good. Why don't you sign on the dotted line? We'll give you a bonus for being a juvenile delinquent above the age of 21. When you come down the abstraction ladder, a lot of the ideology dissipates. When you come down where people, whether they label themselves conservative or liberal, where they live, work, and raise their families, they have to face reality. They're not facing Trumpism, Limbaughism, or all the other illusions of control that are woven around them without any rebuttal by our side, because we've lost radio, talk radio, among other media. Day after day, they're getting this stuff pumped into them, utilizing fundamental, sometimes innocent prejudices, but giving them fangs to develop terrible situations against their own interests, like the poor people in Appalachia are now supporting Republicans. Republicans go and they really spear them in Washington, because the Democrats have abandoned for years the economic issues for the cultural issues, because they're dialing for the same commercial dollars as the Republicans. Imagine the Democratic Party, year after year, is unable to defend our country against the worst Republican Party in history, based on the votes they've pushed through the House of Representatives, which the Democrats do not collect and use against them in the election. Anti-children, anti-woman, pro-Wall Street, pro-more Pentagon waste, pro-more corporate loopholes, tax loopholes for corporations, anti-food safety. I mean, it's like a rogue gallery of madness, and they don't use it. They don't want to upset the corporations that are feeding the Democrat coffers. Imagine what Truman and FDR would have done to today's brand of Republican Party. All right, so this book is all about this. This book is no nonsense. It shows that 1% or less of active involved advocates spread around the country have been responsible for all the major transformations in our country, other than the wars. Civil rights, abolition, slavery, civil liberties, women's right to vote, union rights, the farmer progressive eruption in the late 19th century, regulating the banks and the railroads. All of these have been spearheaded a lot by little third parties, never won an election, and by less than 1% of the people giving a couple hundred hours a year networked on their cause. So why are we so pessimistic? Why don't we say, good heavens, we have the 1% in Wall Street. How about our 1%? As long as we reflect public sentiment, as Abraham Lincoln advised us, we win. When we reflect left-right, we win the landslide. It's an unstoppable. And today, and the book is full of examples, is where even a few dozen people got all kinds of hazardous medicines off the market. They broke through the power of the drug companies. Or a paraplegic student from Oberlin went to work with us, Ralph Hotchkiss, broke the monopoly on crummy wheelchair sales out of London, England, and got production here with a few of his colleagues over the last 30 years, and built and did not patent brand new improvements in wheelchair design to be resilient, not break down, inexpensive, and can maneuver people over uneven surface. And he goes all over the world, in third world, teaching people, poor people, how to build their own wheelchairs with local materials, and then they begin to teach him refinements on the wheelchair. These wheelchairs can do almost anything but fly. You cannot believe these wheelchairs. He was tied in with San Francisco State for many years before the new head decided he wanted to emphasize athletics, and he shooed him out of there to Berkeley. Ralph Hotchkiss. Lois Gibbs, out of Niagara Falls. She's, you know, Love Canal, all that toxic waste under their homes, housing project. She became a massive leader for a grassroots effort right at the neighborhood level against toxics all over the country, winning battle after battle. She never had any experience. You know what she had? She had determination. She had concentration. She had curiosity attached to a purpose in life that she thought she could justify because of the problems with her children and other children and this covered-up toxic waste dump, Hooker Chemical and other chemicals abandoned without telling the homeowners after the developers covered it up, was seeping, you know, into the cellars and so on. This book has a lot of examples. Here's what I'd like you to do. The last thing I want you to do is to leave this wonderful bookstore by a wonderful poet and wonderful staff and say to each other, wasn't that an interesting presentation? Okay? We don't have time for just interesting presentations. The time is for action. The sovereignty is in our hands. We have the power. We've got to give it a cutting edge, organized power through the electoral, through the civic. And just realize this, that the Congress is full of senators represented who are afraid of the people. And they don't want the people to wake up enough to organize. They're pretty shocked by how many are supporting Trump. They didn't understand the simmering resentment that his rhetoric inflamed. They're still afraid of the people. I can assure you of that. Shall we mimic Trump? The members of Congress are afraid of the people. Believe me, okay? I can assure you of that. All right? Keep saying, believe me, believe me. One time my mother wrote a column for the New York Times. And she said, you know, I call up people and they keep saying, believe me. You know, all these believability phrases that people add on, to be honest with you. And she said, why do they have to say that if they're telling the truth? And so Gingrich sets all-time record for saying, for his credibility. It's because he lies so much. And Trump is, you know, the triumph. He's the triumph, the dog, you know. He's a failed gambling czar and a corporate welfare king who's cheated almost everyone categorically he's met, his consumers, workers, creditors, suppliers, taxpayers, cheated on his matrimony, bragged about it, and look where he's come. Look at, see? It's the abandonment of the Democratic Party. He should be easily taking care of that. Reptilian challenge, if you have it. So this has a lot of things in it. I'd like you to buy six at a time. So you have neighborhood meetings on it, and the key pivot is a Congress watchdog group with a letterhead. You start with 50, 100 people. You introduce yourself to the two senators representative. You say what you're going to do is you're going to get more support, and you're going to summon them to town meetings here in the Bay Area. And you're not going to say, well, Nancy Pelosi's a liberal. I mean, she struck out in 2010, 12, 14, is going to strike out again. and they keep reelecting her. They don't even know the rules of baseball because she's a nice person, and she goes around raising money for candidates all over the country. In the meantime, they are dominated by the worst, most craven, vicious, ignorant Republican operatives in the party history since 1854. You don't leave anybody out. And you summon them to a town meeting, and just to make it easy, I've written up a formal summons. It's whereas, you've made a mess of things, Congress, you've made a mess of things. Now, herefore, we summon you to a town meeting at a place of public convenience. We're sending you our materials so you can do your homework and not just smile and nod on us and walk out the door after you hear what we're demanding. We even have drafted bills. It's all there. All you got to do is put your finger to the wind and say, you know, this is the right thing to do. I might get less money from Walmart and J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo. It's the right thing to do because my future depends on it. And I don't want them on my back. The most powerful lobbies, they have three things. They put money in the coffers. In personam lobbying on Capitol Hill and back home, like I said. You think AIPAC has demonstrations? Are you kidding? You think the NRA has marches? They just work on 535. And you talk to people on Capitol Hill and privately, they say, I don't really like AIPAC's demands, but I'm afraid to say it publicly. I say, why? He said, because I just want to get them off my back. I don't have the time. My staff doesn't have the time. So I say yes to them. I say yes to the NRA on background checks and so on. So this distills it all and has a lot of examples and some funny things, actually. I'm not placing much reliance on humor as a conveyor belt. It just relieves the stress once in a while. And let me end on this note. Sometimes on Saturday afternoon, I turn on the network programs, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox. I want to see how our property is being used. Now, there's a lot going on America on Saturday afternoon. There's a lot of good civic breakthroughs, there's all kinds of innovative things in school, in the arts, and in politics, and how we're solving problems here, but it isn't diffused over there, and we can learn from one another. Here's what I found on an average Saturday. Our property was used free by NBC, Fox, ABC, CBS, and over-the-air networks. What did I see on TV this Saturday afternoon? Puffy Cat, Tree Flu Tom, Astro Blast, The Chica Show, World of Adventure, Sports, Action Sports, Track and Field Championships, Infomercials, Golf, U.S. Senior Open, 5 hours on Fox. That must be really exciting. Infomercials, 2.5 hours on ABC of infomercials. You know, kitchen equipment, real sharp knives, cutters, squeezers. Yeah, you buy them all, you get another squeezer.
That was the conclusion of Ralph Nader's talk on his new book, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson.
On this week's show, we finish our four-part series about the economy, so stay tuned.
We are very privileged this morning to have prolific author Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of many books. His latest, Of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. In your book, you write, unless the economy is of the people and by the people, it will never be for the people. Can we talk a little bit about the difference between an economy that is for the people? We've lived through an economic downturn, we lived to a recession, and many people associate the financial collapse with the poor economic states that we are living.
Yes, I think there's an important and fundamental difference between an economy that is actually run by the people and economies which are not. I mean, we've never really had an economy that was run by the people. What we've had are mostly economies run by an elite for the benefit of the elite, with various sizes of crumbs thrown to, you know, those who are not part of the elite. Social democracy was an attempt to change that. It was an attempt to change that by having an elite dedicate itself supposedly to promoting the interests running the economy for everyone, not just for elites. I think that's actually a rather nice way to understand what social democracy was all about. And when you think of it that way, it's a tremendous improvement over economies where the elite run the economy to their own benefit and contrary to the interests of the vast majority. But I think when we start to talk about what's happened in Latin America over the past 30 years, and particularly the last 5 or 6 years, when things have started to move back in the wrong direction, the difference between an economy where the people are actually in charge themselves, and one in which they are relying on a beneficent elite to distribute more of the benefits to them than they have been accustomed to in the past, that's a huge difference. And that transition from a benign rule by social democratic political leaders to a rule where people actually control their own economy is a very difficult transition that really, it's hard to find examples in human history where we have yet made it. But I think we are suffering the consequences of a failure to make that transition to a great extent. I think that explains what's now happening in Latin America.
The idea of social democracy is we put a lot of weight on an election process. Can we talk a little bit about the significance of this? Because in the U.S., how our social movements are doing and how this social democracy has been impacted by the era of neoliberalism and the era of austerity?
I mean, yes, it's important to remember that when Obama was elected in 2008, he was a relatively unknown politician, so it was very difficult, you know, for people to know exactly where he was coming from and what he stood for. And we had just lived through 8 years of George Bush and the disastrous interventions in Iraq and the Mideast. So there was a lot of hope because we were rid of Bush. We were rid of the shame of the world seeing finally that the United States tortures prisoners. And we elected a first black American president, which was a huge accomplishment in the context of the United States racist history. So there was a lot of hope. But Obama never was able to mount a full social democratic program, even with the financial crisis, even with the greatest recession since the 1930s, when there existed the objective possibility that a politician in the mold of Franklin Delano Roosevelt would come in and empower the social movements that wanted to change the way the American economy was working so that it no longer was working clearly for the 1% to the detriment of the 99%. There was a chance to do that. Obama didn't prove to be the politician that wished to lead that. And the social movements and the social forces were not strong enough in the United States to push us, you know, nearly far enough in that direction. As a result, and particularly this is more true in Europe, the Great Recession, the stagnation in the economies of the advanced world has remained longer than during the Great Recession. There's a lot of economists who are now observing that although the depth of the Great Recession in the 30s was deeper than the recession of 2008, 2009, 2010, that we have already remained in this stagnant condition longer than we remained in that stagnant condition during the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that's because we haven't had the response anyplace, certainly not in Europe, where the response has been austerity. counterproductive austerity to the detriment of the European Union, which is coming apart at the seams. And even here in the United States, where we had hopefully elected a progressive Democrat, we didn't get the kind of response that was necessary to really pull us out of the neoliberal trajectory that the U.S. and the global economy has been in for the last 30 years. Now, of course, Latin America was a huge exception to all this. Latin America was the worst to suffer from neoliberalism in global economics, and it was the first to respond successfully to say, no, we are moving away as a continent. It was amazing the extent to which almost every government moved away from a neoliberal trajectory in the late 1990s and the early part of the 20th century. And in some sense, they provided an example about what is leftism and what is socialism and how is it that progressives move forward. They provided the most important examples of how it is that one can combat neoliberalism for a decade or more. But those efforts have fallen on bad times for reasons that are very important to understand.
Perhaps it's important that we distinguish between what an economy is and what the financial collapse was, because there's a difference there. We associate the economic downturn globally with the financial collapse in the U.S. in 2008. Can we demystify those two?
Well, sure. I mean, particularly during the sort of heyday of neoliberal economics, the popular coverage, in the newspapers and the media of economic issues, the first thing they would tell you is, well, what happened to the stock market? The stock market was going up again. Isn't this wonderful? Well, the stock market going up is simply telling you that the price of something called pieces of paper called stocks were rising, and anybody who happened to own a lot of stocks would be very happy that the piece of paper they had bought they could now sell for something more. That has nothing to do with whether or not we are producing more goods, whether we're producing goods that are more useful, whether we're responding to real problems like climate change, and we are transforming our energy industry to be one that's sustainable based on renewables. It doesn't tell you whether or not people have more jobs and better jobs doing more useful things. And we've had neoliberal periods in global capitalism in the past. One of the things that was somewhat different about this version was the degree to which the financial industry had taken over actual industries like automobile industries and the chemical industry. You take a look at which are the companies, the corporations that were most powerful. And in the 1950s, you're looking at GM and IBM. And in the 1990s and 2000s, you're looking at, Goldman Sachs. So we had a new version of neoliberalism in which the financial sector had really increased its power and its control over the economy and the political process. Now, one result of that was that they basically bribed and bullied politicians into deregulating the entire financial sector globally. And that's an accident waiting to happen, and that's exactly what happened when the financial crisis hit. But it's very important for people to keep straight the real economy, which is, are we producing useful goods? Do people have good jobs? From stock prices and how well is Wall Street doing? Those are two entirely different and separate things. And, of course, the thing that we should be caring about is the first. What's happening in the real economy? What's happening to people's jobs, work, and living standards? We really have no interest to care about the other thing except to the extent that it might impact on what we really care about.
We are faced today with both an economic crisis and an ecological crisis. How do we come to a solution that can alleviate and guide us out of both the economic and the ecological crisis that we're facing?
I always go back to the first 2 years of the Obama administration, because in those 2 years, the Democratic Party controlled both the House and the Senate, and we had a new, hopefully progressive Democratic president in the White House. Those were the two critical years when major things could have been accomplished. Now, after the election, after the election of 2010 in the United States, the Republicans had taken over the House of Representatives. they have been engaging and continue to engage in truly unpatriotic, scorched earth political practices. Anything that the Obama administration sent them in forms of legislation, they were absolutely going to completely refuse to cooperate. But in those first 2 years, there was leeway. One of Obama's advisors, people may have seen him as a commentator on the primary elections and the election campaign. He was hired as the energy czar, or the czar for the Green New Deal in the first months of the Obama administration. And he was very quickly dismissed. This is an African-American politician. The right answer to both crises in 2008 and 2009 was a massive stimulus increase in government spending. On what? On what kinds of things? On building the new energy infrastructure and the renewable energies that we so desperately need to avoid climate change. That was the right thing to do. It's still the right thing to do. I mean, is there any hope that we are going to avoid change over the next 30 years? Some things have to happen globally as well, because the development trajectory of the Indias and the less developed economies cannot be through fossil fuel intensive energy development. But in the advanced economies where we enjoyed development through energy intensiveness, all of that has to be changed and transformed. And none of that is happening at the pace that it needs to avoid unacceptable risks of cataclysmic climate change. And what that comes down to in practice is the kind of massive spending where the government is involved with subsidies, the government is involved with purchases of goods and services coming from renewables. That kind of thing is what is necessary. And that's also the best way to put people who lost their jobs during the Great Recession and still haven't gotten them back to work. And it's the way to put the new generation coming out of our educational systems that increasingly face a rather bleak, unemployed future. That's the way to put them to use, doing the most useful thing that we could possibly do as human beings, which is prevent the planet from becoming a place that is an inhospitable host, not only for other species, but for our own, by the end of this century.
You know, in a recent speech, you noted how right after the financial crisis of 2008, 11 million people were put out of work. And 2 years after that, you know, the recession was supposedly ended. And yet 27 million people, you know, and a million more young people were graduating from a system where they had no jobs. So you're quite right. Unless we start to really educate ourselves and know what an economy really is, and as you say, you know, what is the productive nature of our economy? How is it taking care of people? What does our healthcare look like? How does housing look for people? Can we talk a little bit about the role that taxation plays into all this? Because, you know, every politician always talks about cutting taxes and lowering taxes as if that were the solution to all our problems.
There's really two essential issues. One is, are we raising enough revenue for the government to provide the kinds of public good services that are necessary? And I'm going to give you an example of something that's happening here in Oregon. In Oregon, ever since the 1990s, the right-wing anti-tax movement passed something called Measure 5, and then they passed something called Measure 50. Actually, it was Measure 5, 25, and 50. These were three ballot initiatives that they successfully passed in the state of Oregon. And the sum total result of that was basically to deny the state of Oregon the ability to raise sufficient taxes. And as a result, public education in supposedly liberal Oregon, we spend less than every other state except for Louisiana and Mississippi per student on education K through 12. Well, any economist who looks at the global economy of the 21st century will tell you that investing in education and human capital is the way to have a productive and healthy economy in the future. And here we are in Oregon, a supposedly progressive state, and we are lagging way behind. Why is that? Because basically the right wing successfully got people to vote for a reduction in taxes. The first thing you want to ask is, are we raising enough taxes to finance public education, to finance health care, to finance the sort of maintenance of our public infrastructure and the creation of a whole new infrastructure that is not based on fossil fuels? So that's the first question. The answer usually is we're not raising enough, that the anti-government and anti-tax sentiment amongst the voting populace has been exploited to the point where we're simply starving governments of revenue. And that's not to say that governments don't waste money. Federal tax dollars go to the U.S. military. I'd love to change that. The tax dollars in Oregon aren't going to the U.S. military. The tax dollars are going to education and health care, and there's just not enough of them. The second question is, well, who should pay? And the answer is, well, people and organizations should pay their fair share. Guess what? The corporations pay a smaller percentage of taxes in Oregon than any other state in the United States. We are 50 out of 50 in terms of how much of the revenue that we do collect, we collect from corporations. Well, that's just absolutely unacceptable. So one of the things that we are hopefully going to do here in Oregon, we have something called Measure 97 that's going to be on the ballot in November. This state's going to easily vote for Clinton, not Trump. But the real issues are we have some ballot measures that are far more important than the progressives in Oregon are working on, because we don't have to worry about Clinton not winning the election in Oregon. Those electoral votes are going to definitely go to Clinton and not Trump. But the Measure 97 essentially is going to raise $3 extra billion per year in a fairly small state. We're only 5 million people in Oregon. We're going to raise an extra $3 billion a year from corporations, but not just from all corporations. We're raising the tax on large out-of-state corporations like Walmart, Target, corporations that do more than $25 million worth of sales in the state of Oregon. So that's how you fix tax problems. We had a terrible situation in Oregon where we were starving the state, you know, for necessary revenues. We're going to raise an extra $3 billion, which is a very significant amount per year, and we're going to get it from the people who haven't been paying their fair share, the large corporations. That's good tax reform. What is Donald Trump talking about? He wants to eliminate the inheritance tax, and he wants to substitute a flat tax. When people hear flat tax, they basically need to understand is a flat tax is a tax where the wealthier people, the higher income people, don't pay their fair share. They pay no more than everybody else does. So if you think that poor people should have the same tax burden as rich people, then that's what a flat tax is. And of course, that's the kind of proposal that's coming out of Donald Trump. What else would you expect?
Now, when he talks about removing the inheritance tax, why is this significant and why should we take notice?
We have a whole movement called Occupy that brings attention to the fact that, you know, the top 1% have been essentially gobbling up, you know, a majority of the productivity gains in the U.S. and really the global economy for the past 30 years. So if you think that we have a problem of inequality and we have an unfair system of income distribution, if you think the people at the very top are getting too much and the people at the bottom are getting too little, the primary means by which the people at the top continue to get more than their fair share is through inheritance. You take a look at wealthy people and wealthy families. Well, how do they get wealthy? There was a great study that was done that had a wonderful title. It was called Being Born on Third Base. And the whole idea is this is baseball. I know in Canada you play baseball, but it's our national pastime. So the idea is that ordinary people have to stand in the batter's box and they have to hit and they have to get the first base, then second base, then third base before they can get home to score a run. And the whole point was, well, if you take a look at how it is that wealthy people become wealthy, they start on third base with a huge inheritance that they got from their ancestors. So a progressive approach to taxation, it's probably more important to tax wealth than to tax income. So taxing wealth is better than taxing income. So it's not surprising that you would hear you know, Trump campaigning for abolishing the inheritance tax. There's one subject upon which he is, you know, on the same page as his fellow Republicans.
A very small group of people determine who gets to live and who gets to die, because we can eat dollars. We can eat paper. We need fresh, you know, clean air, clean water. And the more we obscure the urgency of remediating the ecological crisis that we leave, the longer we are amassing the numbers of people that will die as a result of it. So can we talk a little bit about this? Because normally we say, well, of course the U.S. and Canada can't do much because China won't change their emissions, so it would be unfair for us. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That impression is just completely and totally erroneous about China. China is doing more to reduce emissions than any other country on the planet by a considerable margin. And that even includes Germany. And Germany, in terms of environmental policy, is way in front of most of the other countries in the European Union. So it's Germany that pushes the European Union in the right direction to be more ambitious about reducing emissions. But China has been doing things, you know, at a pace beyond what even Germany has done. The laggards are the United States. The laggards are Canada. Here's where there's a truth. Suppose the U.S. and Canada and Europe dramatically reduced emissions, and suppose China and India did not. Suppose China and India went through the same form of fossil fuel intensive industrialization that the rest of us did. In some sense, you'd say, well, I mean, the rest of us did this, and that's why there's a problem. We put all those greenhouse gases up there for the past century. Is it fair to deny poor countries, underdeveloped countries, China and India, and the masses of people that haven't benefited from economic development, is it right to deny them the right to the same thing? That's a moral case which I think you can make. On the other hand, there is a scientific truth, which is even if the advanced economy now reduced our emissions down to zero by 2050, if China and India went through the same industrialization process that the rest of us did in the 20th century, if they did that now in the 21st century, we would still have unacceptable climate change. But the truth of the matter is that China in particular is not showing any signs of doing that. They're the ones producing all the solar panels. They're the ones that are dramatically changing their energy system and their energy grid so as not to be dependent on coal and fossil fuel. Now, part of this is driven by self-interest. They have a tremendous local pollution problem, air pollution problem, that is coming from all the coal they've been burning. So to get off coal for them is to mitigate a public health disaster for themselves. But it is also a tremendous contribution. If you take a look at the pledges that the different countries made in Paris, at the Paris climate meetings, people should go to a website. It's called EcoEquity, just www.ecoequity.com. Dot org. And that's a website where you can go in and see an evaluation of every proposal that every country came to Paris to, in terms of every country was supposed to say, this is our pledge, this is how much we are promising we will reduce over the next 10 years, 20 years, etc. And you can see the evaluations of those pledges. China is pledging to do more than its fair share. It's the United States, Europe, Canada that are pledging to do roughly half their fair share. Now, China is not alone in that. The striking outcome from Paris was to what extent every underdeveloped country, when you take fairness into account, when you take differential responsibility and capability into account, how pretty much every underdeveloped or less developed country was pledging to do their fair shares in Paris, and the shortfall, the reason that all those pledges were adding up to way too little, was the advanced economies were still pledging to do less than their fair share. Is it true that if China continues to expand emissions throughout the 21st century in such a big country that the rest of us are cooked no matter what we do? Yes, but there is absolutely no evidence that that's what China is doing. The real laggards are the ones who put most of the stuff up there in the first place, and continue to insist that they're just unwilling to cut back on emissions sufficiently.
If you were elected to advise the new elected president of the U.S., what would be the three things that you would encourage them to adapt immediately to create a more productive economy and to address climate change?
What such a person should do is launch a Green New Deal. I mean, you and Canada have had a sensible medical system for quite a while. We alone amongst the advanced economies have had a nonsensical private, medical system. Obamacare was a step in the right direction, but it was a half step, and as a result, it's got some serious problems associated with it. I would say the two things are of having a single-payer healthcare system and launch a Green New Deal. The government needs to attack climate change the same way that it was attacking getting prepared to defeat fascism when World War II broke out. That's the kind of urgency. Bill McKibben said it recently. He said, we are at war. We are in a global war, to save ourselves and the planet. And it's just as urgent as the war against fascism, World War II.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for all the work that you do. Thank you for your beautiful book, Of the People, by the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. Thank you again for being with us today.
It was great being with you. Talk to you again soon.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ralph Nader, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. I recorded this talk on October 18, 2016, just 3 weeks before Election Day. A group of young people handed out Bernie-crat flyers to the audience that had already filled the small City Lights bookstore in San Francisco to capacity an hour before Ralph Nader was expected to arrive. Nader was going to talk about his new book, published by City Lights under the title Breaking Through Power. From the advance reviews, we knew that he was not going to advocate for any party, blue, red, or green, in spite of his own former affiliation with the Green Party, and not even for Sanders in particular. He was going to lay out a specific plan how to take power ourselves and apply it directly to Congress without the mediation or intervention of any party. In what many experience as an age of powerlessness of ordinary people, that may seem like a far-flung goal, but you will hear in a moment how simple it actually can be. Nader's own life story and success in standing up to power, be it for car safety, healthier food, clean environment, and for a safer workplace, for more than 5 decades. All that shows that even one person with a small staff and organization can have a lasting influence. And he probably has affected all of our lives in some way. Add to that examples of other individuals who Nader mentions by name, who prevented industrial toxins from poisoning their children or fighting for safe water and air. We have an abundance of examples of breaking through power. In his book and talk, Nader lays out a very concrete plan of how to expand these individual stories into a coherent movement that is specific in its goals, can unite left and right, and takes power on a national scale. Here's Ralph Nader. The first to step up to the microphone was Elaine Katzenberger, editor of City Lights. She introduces Matt Gonzalez, who introduces Nader.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to City Lights. This is a very special night indeed. I believe it's the first time ever that Ralph Nader is here at City Lights Books, and it's certainly the first time that we have published a book by Ralph Nader. So this is a really proud and wonderful evening for us. It's really an honor to be his publisher. Ralph Nader is a hero, obviously. So first up is Matt Gonzalez, who will be introducing Ralph for you. Matt Gonzalez is chief attorney of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office and the former president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And he very valiantly ran for mayor here against a machine and didn't quite make it. That was really very grateful. I think we should all be grateful for Matt. He's a recipient of numerous awards, including the 2000 Lawyer of the Year Award, In Defense of Animals Guardian Award, and the Bert Corona Award from the California's Mexican-American Political Association. Matt continues to do all kinds of work for the city of San Francisco, and all of us are lucky to have him here. Please welcome Matt Gonzalez. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a real delight to be here. I don't think I've seen Ralph Nader since 2008. And, of course, 2016, we would be just at the end of our second term in office. I like to think our Attorney General, Jello Biafra, would be filing lawsuits against Donald Trump. Interior Secretary Winona LaDuc would be shutting down the Dakota Access Pipeline. Secretary of State Cornel West would be with our U.N. Ambassador Julian Assange in Syria. But, you know, I'm kidding, but there is something to be said about what could be, you know. And I think that this book that Ralph has written is really about citizens taking back the power that they truly have. And I don't know if you want to, you know, refer to it as capitalism or neoliberalism or whatever you want to call it. But the system in place, you know, allows people to be satisfied with the table scraps, you know, the breadcrumbs. And this book is really about trying to ignite something with people. It says, hey, the kitchen's over there. The cupboard's full of food. You know, do something about it. I remember being with Ralph in Ohio. And a journalist asked me, what are the two of you doing to get into the debates? And I said, well, what are you doing to get us in the debates? You know, and I think it just goes to the core of what this is all about. Ralph was born in Connecticut in early 1934. Unsafe at Any Speed was published the year I was born. I'm 51, give you an idea. His long-term activism in pushing forward legislation, you know, whether it's the Freedom of Information Act, Clean Water, automotive safety, all kinds of things. He really is, as Elaine said, a legend, and I'm delighted to see him again, and this is really a very fine book, and I'm glad you're all here. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Matt. Yeah, it was a very frustrating campaign. Not 20% of the people knew we were running. It's a total blackout. You know, I think we got 4 minutes on the national news in 10 weeks. And it was all devoted to how do you feel spoiling the Democrats. So we're dealing with a tyranny, a two-party tyranny, that excludes competition in all kinds of legal and illegal ways, legal because they control the state legislature, and require, for example, 300,000 signatures here in California for an independent candidate to get on the ballot, because you got to get double the number because they disqualify so many signatures. When you don't have a competitive election, you're not a democracy, period. That's what it's all about. It's a duopoly, and they're strumming the tune of Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. So this book is designed to break it up, and it's a very short book. I've learned to pay attention to short attention spans of our present culture. And what is involved, let me just flip it. If I was a betting person and I could get a surety, I could say, tap one of those mega billionaires in Silicon Valley who has a conscience or enlightened, and for $1 billion we can turn the country around. So this is just a challenge. How would you turn the country around if somebody gave you $1 billion in 36 months to do it? And when you ask students that, you know, the best, quote, universities and working in political science and anthropology and so on, they don't have a clue how to answer it. I've had answers like, well, you increase voter registration. I've had answers why you start a third party. They don't have a clue because they never ask the question, as Matt said, what if? If you don't ask the question, what if, you can't envision real possibilities. And we don't have a practical utopian culture where we ask the question, what if? What if we had 1,000 organizers full-time on the ground, two in every congressional district, and 10 or 15 on Capitol Hill in Washington to push full Medicare for all? What would happen? We'd get it, because you have left-right support for that. It's cheaper, it's better, it's less anxious. You just need a card like Canada, and you're set. And you have a free choice of doctor and hospital, which you don't have with all these networks and all the complexities, mind-blowing exemptions, deductibles, complex deductibles, and all the nonsense that fritter away people's time and increase the anxiety level of millions of people. And then they don't end up getting health insurance covered when they need it. And you know how many people are working on that now, full time? My best guess, zero. They've agreed to settle it. You got a gridlock Congress. Forget about it. You got Obamacare. Now is not the time. Zero. We would audit the Pentagon with $1 billion. You easily could get the Pentagon audited because it's violating federal law since 1992. The only department and agency that doesn't provide an audit to the GAO accounting arm of Congress. It's only $650 billion, not counting all the dark budgets, a year. Therefore, they couldn't account for $9 billion lost in Iraq in the first year of the criminal invasion. The Air Force buys billions of dollars of supplies because they don't have audited warehouses that have those same supplies, and on and on. So how would you spend $1 billion? Here's what I would do. I would organize about 2,000 people in every congressional district. Because when you say, well, how do you want to change the country? Well, some of it we can do ourselves. You know, we can put solar panels up, and we can eat nutritious organic food, and we can do this and that. And that's important. You practice what you preach, and you build awareness. But for better and for worse, Congress is the Khyber Pass. Congress is the most powerful branch of government, and it happens to be the most personal branch of government, and it happens to have a name on 535 people. And they put their shoes on like you and I do every night, and they want to get reelected. And it's nice to replace a lot of them, but if you had $1 billion, you wouldn't have to replace many of them. You just have to put the kind of pressure that on occasion we did in the 60s and early 70s and change corporate members of the Congress into consumer and environmental champions, led by Nixon, who signed into law EPA, OSHA, Product Safety Commission, wanted to give the vote to the District of Columbia, had a better health plan than Clinton did years later, and had a minimum incomes plan to combat poverty. He was way ahead of Congress because he feared the people. He feared the rumble of the people from the 60s. He was the last Republican to fear liberals. It was all downhill after that. So you would basically hire 1,000, couple thousand seasoned organizers. Put them in every congressional district. And depending on who represents the district, it could be the 20% really progressive members of Congress. You wouldn't have to unload on them as much, But you would organize 2,000 people in each district. Every district has community colleges, neighborhood leaders, lawyers, teachers, technicians, good blue-collar workers who don't take mush for an answer, etc. And you would say, we want you to commit 200 to 500 hours a year around a transformational agenda of, say, a dozen directions, which I'll point out, and we want you to raise or contribute $200 to $300 a year to open up full-time offices of 3-4 people in every congressional district, so all this volunteer time connected with all the other Congress watchdog groups around the country can have full-time advocacy. All right, so that costs about $100 million to do that a year before it gets self-sustaining. So you got money left over. You got $1 billion. What do you do with the rest? You open up an in personam lobbying effort right on Capitol Hill. The most successful lobbyists do not have marches and demonstrations. I am all for marches and demonstrations. You get new people in, you get some reasonable press, and you arouse people's sense of possibility. But what happens when these marches and demonstrations are overwhelmingly on weekends and the energy goes into the ether? It's not focused laser-like on what? 100 senators and 435 members of the House. Now, the most successful lobbyists, have you ever seen a mass demonstration in Washington and San Francisco by the military-industrial complex demanding more nuclear subs and F-35s? They don't operate that way. They know everything about those 535 that's possible to know. Their votes, who owns them, who they play golf with, who's a doctor, accountant, lawyer, clergyman, staff. They pump money in, and they have all kinds of dossiers. And they basically say, if you don't want a primary challenger, it's sub rosa, for those who resist a bit. And they get a majority. 1,500 corporations get a majority of the members of Congress, and they don't have a single vote. What are we doing out here? Reading muckraking books? Terrific documentaries? Golden age. Can't imagine how much of this country is exposed down to the iota by reporters, editors, organizers. And where's it going? Do you ever read the last page of these books? Gerrymander, where are you? Yeah, Jerry. Jerry, you know, and I liked the book that came out called Not So Fast. It's a critique of technology and bad analysis of repercussions. The companies accentuate biotech, nanotech, artificial intelligence, and other, you know, medicines. They don't talk about the risks and all the other unintended so-called consequences. And I read the book. It's a really good book. It shows all the conflicts over 50, 60 years, worrying about the bomb, what happens when you get the bomb, and it gets proliferated, worrying about all these other technologies. And the last page completely tailed off, left the reader with nothing. And that's done again and again and again. So where are we with massive disclosure? We're overwhelmed and overloaded with information. How about connecting knowledge to action? The old Ming Dynasty philosopher who said in the 14th century, I don't know, the wisdom of the ancients, how do they get this wisdom? No email, no fax machine, no telephone, no Facebook account? I mean, what's going on here? Listen to this wisdom. Quote, it's 14th century. To know and not to do is not to know. End quote. Marcus Cicero, over 2,000 years ago, Roman lawyer, freedom is participation in power. We define freedom as, you know, get off my back, don't invade my privacy, don't assault, don't surveil. I mean, that's freedom from. It's freedom to that we've got to demand. We don't have civic freedom in this country. We have personal freedom. We can buy the books, music, have our choose our friends, our clothes, what we want to eat. That's personal freedom. That's not civic freedom. Dictatorships allow personal freedom. And so, okay, so you have an in personam crew. All they do is go up on Capitol Hill. That's all they do every day. The corridors weave their way between the corporate lobbyists. get to know the staff, the reporters covering from back home, the senators, the representatives, the connections with the executive branch, etc. The kind of thing 360.org is trying to do back home. Do you know there isn't, to my knowledge, one person going up on Capitol Hill as we speak lobbying on climate change? That surprise you, all the environmental groups? You know why? It's called gridlock. They've given up for the time being. So they lobby EPA, try to help the coal pollution reg. They lobby the usual executive branch stuff. But Congress is like stasis. It's paralyzed. Can't get anything through. Total nonsense. I wrote a letter about 3-4 years ago to Tom Steyer, George Soros, and Al Gore. And they're all, big on climate change. And, they got a lot of money. And I said, put in $20 million a year and get 130, 140 people, really seasoned scientists, lawyers, public relations, organizers, whatever, to lobby Congress in personam on Capitol Hill every day and to work the press, connect back home. You know what the answer was? Indirectly through their staff, that's not where the action is. Really? When I go up on Capitol Hill, I bump into coal lobbyists, gas lobbyists, oil lobbyists, nuclear lobbyists. Somehow they think that's where the action is. All right, so what do you do with the rest of the $1 billion? Well, that's what we got to figure out. But here's what we can get in a 36-month period. You got to span an election. And you don't have to replace that many. Starts out 25% or so on our side from the get-go. Here's what we'd get. We'd get enough audit and pressure on the Congress, on the Pentagon, to de-bloat the military budget. The military budget is so crassly wasted, it staggers even a Nietzschean imagination. You wouldn't believe what's going on in terms of theft by the military-industrial complex. The waste, the duplication, the redundant weaponry designed for a Soviet Union era of hostility. We would smash most of the corporate welfare. That's a left-right support. See, the reason why we can win is I'm going to read you about 20 transformations that are supported left-right back home. And that's an unbeatable combination. You walk into a senator's office with 50 people or 20 people, and you say, we're conservatives and we're liberals, they turn pale. Because they can game the liberals. If you're a right-winger or a liberal, they can game the conservative. They cannot game a convergence. There's a book here by me called Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. So they don't like Wall Street over Main Street. The right-wingers want to break up the big banks. George Will writes columns saying, if banks are too big to fail, they're too big to exist. And Ron Paul and Barney Frank combined before they left the House to go after the military budget. There's a libertarian, liberal Democrat. You can see it. The reason why we don't see it in the headlines is because the divide and rule strategy of 2,000 years or more by the ruling powers is to focus on reproductive rights, gun control, school prayer, those kinds of issues that, if they're not superficially divisive, they are genuinely divisive. Ideologically or religiously or what have you. We would have a living wage. That would be a slam dunk. You think the conservative workers in Walmart are going to fall on their axe and say, no, I don't want $15 an hour. I like $9.50 an hour. I'm a conservative. I want to conserve the money that the CEO of Walmart is paying himself. $12,000 an hour, not counting benefits. By noon, if he doesn't take a restroom break, by noon on January 2, he's earned more than one of any million Walmart workers in a year, not counting benefits. That's an easy one. Gather uncollected taxes. The IRS is being squeezed, so every dollar they lose, they can't collect $10 in taxes. What's the uncollected taxes? $400 billion. That's not counting tax, tax havens and the shenanigans where GE doesn't pay any taxes because they've rigged the tax system. and they make billions of dollars and pay less taxes in dollars than one worker in GE. Billions of dollars of U.S. profits. We'd have a Wall Street speculation tax. How come we have to pay sales tax when we buy a book here, right? Yeah. Right? How come if someone buys tomorrow $100 million of Exxon derivatives, they don't pay a penny? Sales tax. And the volatility is fantastic. You're talking trillions of dollars in terms of derivatives. Tiny percent of 1% can produce hundreds of billions of dollars. The transforming into solar energy and efficiency from fossils and nuclear. That could be a transformational policy in place, 3% a year, as David Freeman has pointed out, used to run four public utilities, including SCUD and the TVA. 3% a year, in 30 years or so, we're out of there. No fossil fuels, no nuclear power plants. Oh, allowing standing to sue. One way they get us is there's this ancient doctrine that if you don't have a vested economic interest, you can't sue the government because they wasted your money or they criminally invaded another country. And so that knocks the judicial branch completely out of the three-branch concept of our government. And they basically say, the judges say, well, you're just a citizen, you're a taxpayer, you have no standing to sue, you can't even get into the courtroom door. Knocks out a lot of challengers of the corporate state, which is what we have now. We have a merger of big business, big government, with the big government thirsting to resign or leave high government posts to work for big business. That's the Wall Street, Washington merry-go-round. Expand direct democracy, not just in California. There 25 states don't have the initiative, referendum and recall, and there are other forms of direct democracy. So if our representatives don't represent us, they represent corporatism, for example, we just bypass them. And that has to couple with two other changes. One is campaign finance reform, public financing of public elections, so they can't use the California initiative against you, like the tobacco companies and others have tried to do. I mean, we'd be $80 million of insurance money in Prop 103 in 1988 with $2 million, because we had the LA Times and others on our side. And we've saved California consumers $100 billion, according to the leading actuary, J. Robert Hunter. But that's a rare thing. And the other one is, what are we doing giving away our public airwaves and monopoly cable license, getting nothing in return? I mean, to what level do we descend into the status of being saps? Right? We give the public airways 24/7 to commercial stations and quasi-commercial toadies like NPR and PBS. And they use it 24 hours a day. They use it 24 hours a day to decide who says what, who doesn't, who gets on and who doesn't. Most of it is entertainment and advertising. They take off the table huge voices of the people of concern about the depraved situation in our country, the deteriorating situation, self-censoring themselves to unimaginable profits, and they do it free. We charge them no rent. We're landlords. The FCC is our real estate agent, and they've made sure Congress says, you get it free. You turn that around. You say to Congress, No, little boys and girls, from now on, you're obeying us, the sovereign people. And we'll show you how we're going to enforce that with summons, formal summons for town meetings regularly. You report back to us. We control the town meetings. We're going to have the agenda. You're just going to listen and study and go back and do what you're told, because we have a left-right coalition, and we have the evidence and the humanity behind it. And so we should have our own audience network.
That was Ralph Nader speaking 3 weeks before the 2016 election about his new book, Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, offering encouragement and inspiration at a time when so many felt uneasy and powerless about the available presidential choices. Nader spoke for an hour, and you will need to come back for the next broadcast of TUC Radio to hear the conclusion. He spoke in the loved and respected over 60-year-old City Lights bookstore in San Francisco. Nader's new book had just been published by City Lights in the Open Media series. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So what we wanted to do was to be able to talk about what does democratic socialism mean to millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. And Bernie Sanders has done that.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hanel. This is segment 3 in a 4-part series on the economy, so stay tuned.
On our conversation about the economy, what is an economy? What is a productive economy? How do we create a participatory economy that engages people and inspires people with a vision of an inclusive, more just, and productive society? We talked about, you know, the beautiful example of Venezuela, you know, in the recent years of creating a participatory economy, an economy for the people, by the people, where you highlighted that an economy that has populist redistribution can create beautiful possibilities where people can become engaged, and how the more participatory an economy is, the more people take ownership and responsibility for creating more of that. Can we talk a little bit about the barriers, the challenges we face, and what are some of the obstacles that make it difficult for us to create that kind of productive share economy?
Well, I mean, I think Venezuela, again, let's stick with that as an excellent example and learning experience. I mean, the first obstacle they faced was the complete and total hostility from the U.S. government, which aided and abetted a very tiny percentage of the population, the wealthy plutocracy, in an attempt, a military coup attempt to overthrow this government, which was nationalizing multinational interests that were not serving the interests of Venezuelans. And that was using things like the oil revenue, you know, to provide benefits for the poor population. So that's the first thing. You do face worldwide, but particularly in Latin America, and particularly as close as Venezuela is, and as close as the United States' involvement in Venezuela has been, Exxon Oil Company basically built itself into a world power on the basis of its ownership of the oil fields in Venezuela.
The reason Venezuela had great baseball players is that Venezuela was very much a U.S. colony during the first half of the 20th century. So that's the first obstacle, that you face the implacable opposition of the U.S. government, the most powerful government and military force on the planet, and you're in our backyard. And you have to be a complete and total fool not to be aware of the fact, you know, that the U.S. is looking for any opportunity to throw you out of power as you move in this direction. The more you move in the direction we're talking about, because you're asking, what are the obstacles to moving in the direction that we've been talking about? Well, the more you move in that direction, the more implacable the opposition and the more intense the opposition from the U.S. government's going to be. And that's not going to change with Hillary Clinton. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there is an internal opposition. They have engaged in the kind of politics the Republican Party is engaged in vis-a-vis Obama for the past 6 years, scorched earth. They will do anything they can to create situations where there's chaos, where there's no food that's available. They will go out of their way to go ahead and create the conditions whereby people will lose faith in this government that's trying to move in this direction. And the harder you try and move in this direction, the more implacable their opposition will be. And they still control most of the jobs and most of the production in Venezuela. At some point, you're going to have to deal with that. I'd say there's two other things. One is political. Have people really figured out that we have sort of agreement about what are the steps that you take in order to build a participatory socialist, eco-socialist economy? Do we know how to do that? Is there agreement on how to do that? Do we have a plan in mind, or are we kind of winging it and feeling our way as we go? Well, we were very much doing the latter. So there was a government that was trying to feel its way toward what is this new kind of 21st century socialism going to be like. And it didn't really have sort of plans and strategies well worked out, that it had agreement amongst its own cadre and its own thinkers and its own leaders. That's the third problem, the third obstacle you have to overcome. The fourth obstacle is the one I was referring to briefly when I said most people have been told all their lives, and this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, you aren't smart enough and capable enough to make the important economic decisions that affect you. You just have to trust somebody smarter than you, somebody more clever than you, somebody better educated than you to go ahead and make those decisions. Or otherwise, the economy isn't going to work very well for you or anybody else. Has there ever been a time when human beings, since we lived in small clans where most economic activity was done through cultural institutions and it was self-directed activity, ever since we developed into societies that were class societies, class means a small number of people are ordering a large number of people. And we have been living in class economies and class societies for thousands of years. That is a tremendous inertia to overcome. It's a tremendous inertia to overcome. So those are the obstacles that need to be overcome in the case of Venezuela and in sort of general. And they're not easy. It's a very difficult path. I think it's important for all of us who see that as our goal in some broad sense to appreciate where it is that people have taken more steps and more successful steps along that path and have generated learning experiences for the rest of us. And that is my feeling about Venezuela. As sad as I am about the way things are going right now, I still have a tremendous respect and admiration for the fact that they have done more there than anybody has any place else to try and figure out how it is that we march on this difficult, difficult path to overcome these very difficult obstacles.
I agree with you that it's a strategy is very useful and is absolutely something we have to work towards. I would disagree that it's inevitable for us to make change without it, because we have seen that they did. What I would like to focus on perhaps maybe how do we hold on to the gains that were made, being fully and wide awake to the challenges we are facing, because the challenges are many, but also the gains we have made are very palpable and real, and they have made significant transformations in the lives of people, primarily the poorest in Venezuela and in some of the regions that were affected by the changes they made.
My own sense would be, if I were there and if I were involved in those discussions, I would be pointing out, look, we always should have been moving from serve the people in the direction of with power for the people. We've had that slogan around for a long time, since the 1960s. You can go back to the Black Panther Party here in the United States. And there's a big difference between we are trying to serve ordinary people, particularly poor people in need, and we are trying to empower them to take what is theirs and do with it what they decide to do. We always knew we needed to be making that transition. Now we face a situation where oil revenues are down, where the economy is in rather bad shape. You know, export prices have fallen for things other than oil, where there's less and less medicines in the clinics, not more and more clinics with more and more medicines. So we're in a situation where we actually don't have as much to redistribute in order to sort of serve the interests of the masses of Venezuela. The only way to go forward is to basically empower them to take the power themselves. There's two ways to respond to the fact that there's less to redistribute. One is to cut back on redistribution and just hope that you can hang on to political power until things get better. And I think that's unfortunately one of the tendencies. The other reaction is, okay, there is less to redistribute. We never wanted to be about redistribution in the first place. We wanted to be about empowerment. So let's crank up the energy and the ideas and the strategy that has to do with empowering people in a situation where we actually can't increase the amount of redistribution we're doing at this point anyway. But it's not easy. These are things that are easier said than done. Yeah. Let me put it that way. There's a lot in life that's easier said than done.
Wouldn't you agree then that the solution seems to be both, you know, in different contexts, almost the same one, you know, increase the power, increase the access people have both to the political levers by means of education, political education, but also sharing of, you know, the resources that are essential to life, to engagement, to participation.
But in the particular case of Venezuela, not only do you need to be working on empowering those people who have received material benefits from redistribution over the past 15 years, you need to be taking the power out of the hands of your enemies. And as long as you leave the major part of the economy in the hands of the private employers who are implacably opposed to a continuation of this government, they want to go back to the way Venezuela was in 1955. They want to go back to when the oligarchy in Venezuela was literally ruling over 95% of the population, who were simply destitute masses. Now you've got a huge chunk of the population that is going to, you know, would have a hard time stomaching that. So you need to empower them so that they can defend themselves, but you also need to take that economic power away from your political enemies. Instead of using oil revenues to make loans to start up small, you know, workers' co-ops, you actually, now that you have less rural revenues and you can do less of that, you need to actually go out and start taking over the businesses that have been deliberately sabotaging the economy, trying to get a political counter-revolution. You need to actually go out and start doing that. Now, why would you hesitate? Well, that's going to increase tension. That's going to further anger the opposition. that's going to further embolden the U.S. media and the State Department to say, oh, my gosh, look what they're doing. They're expropriating private property in Venezuela. Yes, it's scary. On the other hand, if you don't move in that direction, where will the inevitable end? Right now, the trend is definitely in the wrong direction.
If you were appointed to President Maduro's council and you were to implement, you know, a recovery strategy, this very process of empowerment, what would be your top three recommendations as we moved into this period of unknown? Because, you know, we are making the road as we walk.
I would take the step which the Bolivarian Revolution has yet, I mean, what are we now, 15 years? And they have avoided any sort of large-scale nationalizations of the private sector. There have been some around the edges. There have been some that just sort of had to be done. That happens in countries that are not trying to build 21st century socialism. They really have done no more of that than countries, you know, that aren't trying to build 21st century socialism. They've put that off for a very long time. I can sympathize with why it was put off. It was put off because, first of all, it is provocative, and so you risk creating a political crisis. It was put off because I think they were incredibly honest. They said in the very beginning, well, what are we going to do if we tip over these private businesses? How will we organize people to run them? And the Cubans said, well, we'll show you how to do, you know, socialist planning Cuban style. And they said, but we don't think that works. That's not what we want. And I think they were right about that. So they were incredibly honest and said, "We're part of the reason we're not going to take over private businesses are we have to learn and feel our way toward how to run them better. And so instead of just large-scale socialism nationalizations in the early years and having the Cubans come in and set up the Cuban planning system, instead of doing that, they very wisely started building the social economy slowly so they could figure out how do we want to run things. We don't want to take over anything that we don't know we can run better. But I think that they've had those years. They've done some of that. And at this point, they have to take that step. So I think they need to take over businesses that are being deliberately mismanaged in a way that is creating economic chaos inside Venezuela, all of which just discourages the population, discourages your supporters, and emboldens your enemies. I think they need to be much more aggressive about taking those over. And they need to go ahead and whatever they've learned about how you can run businesses non-capitalistically in these years with the social economy, they need to put it to good use and see how it goes.
So how do we take some of that responsibility, you know, of creating a social context where a beautiful revolution like the one that took place in Venezuela, and we call it a beautiful revolution because, you know, they didn't have to kill 50% of their people in order to liberate themselves and start dreaming of a socialist economy and start dreaming of a different way of connecting and creating that productive economy that serves all of the people, not just a few.
Sylvia, I'm very glad you said that. We need to step back and recognize what a momentous achievement it is to have moved as far as they have moved without having, you know, massive percentages of the population being killed in warfare. That's an incredible accomplishment, you know, that they should be proud of and that we should appreciate. You're Canadians and it's a little different, except you basically just are part of our foreign policy. That's your problem. Your problem is, have your own foreign policy and don't just hitch your wagon to the U.S. That's what you need to fight for in Canada. In the United States, the first thing that people need to do is we need to work to try and prevent our government from being the one that stops the Venezuelans from doing what they're trying to do. And the second thing is that those of us who want to have more progressive economies and societies, we need to learn lessons from what they've been doing in Venezuela. They have been doing things that we can learn lessons from. This is how you do this. This is how it works. This is where you're going to run into problems. This is how you cope with it. they're decades ahead of us, and we can learn from their experience. It doesn't mean we have to sit here and say everything that their government says that we agree with, that that's the right way to do things. But we should recognize that they have accomplished so much more than we have. They're decades ahead of us on the road we'd like to be on, and we need to keep our government from stopping them. That's the primary things that people in the United States can do.
As we approach the U.S. election, what are your hopes in terms of our social movements here and the moment that calls us at this time?
Well, it looks like Trump is imploding. It looks like Hillary Clinton would have to do something incredibly stupid to blow this election. Having said that, I would also say this is a year where all of the polls and all of the expectations have proven to be wrong over and over again, that the anti-establishment sentiment in the U.S. political in U.S. politics right now and in European politics right now, the anti-establishment political sentiment has never been higher for 50 years. And that makes it very difficult to be very confident about predicting electoral outcomes. But I am hopeful that Clinton will win. I'm hopeful that she will win in a landslide, because as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, they will continue to engage in scorched earth policy. Anything that requires a law to be passed, to change at the federal level. If Clinton is elected, but the Republicans continue to hold on to the House, it makes it very difficult for us to make any sort of progress in terms of national policy and changes in national laws. That includes spending. That includes health care. So that's my fear. My expectation is we'll have a Clinton in the White House and the Republicans will be further embittered and in scorched earth mode over in the House of Representatives. So we'll have divided government just as we've had divided government under Obama. Let's leave Trump and the anti-establishment sentiment on the right wing of U.S. politics aside. Something has happened in the U.S. political scene that has not happened here probably in 80 years. And that is the Bernie Sanders, our revolution, the Bernie Sanders candidacy through the Democratic primaries has essentially mobilized people who are of a progressive mind, who are disgusted not only with Republicans and Tea Partiers, but the Democratic Party establishment presiding over 30 years of neoliberal economic policy and 30 years of increasingly dysfunctional imperial wars and interventions. That has been mobilized to a greater extent, than my lifetime. I have long believed that the U.S. left needs a multi-pronged strategy. We need to build social movements. We need to build experiments in equitable cooperation. And we need some sort of productive way to engage in electoral politics, not just locally, but at the national level. I believe that because the United States is a very politically immature society. U.S. citizens, on average, spend less time thinking about politics than citizens in any other country in the world that I have ever been in, and that includes very poor countries. In poor countries, people are much more politically savvy and sophisticated than they are in the United States. On top of that, the little attention that most Americans pay to politics is focused on the 6 months before a presidential election. So how can you be a serious political movement and have no successful way of engaging with people when they're paying attention to political issues? That's been our dilemma. And we've had that dilemma now for presidential election after presidential election. Do we do third party? Do we do the Greens? Do we run safe state or do we run strategy? How do we approach this? And we have a very difficult situation because we are a two-party duopoly. We don't have three or four parties. We don't have a parliamentary system. So it's very difficult to figure out how do you participate as progressive forces in the U.S. political presidential electoral season which is the time when you can actually talk to most Americans about anything political. We haven't had an answer to that, and I think Bernie Sanders has given us the answer. You have to run progressive candidates in the Democratic primaries. And if you win and you have basically taken over the Democratic Party, fabulous. If you don't win in the general election, you do not engage in a policy like, unfortunately, Jill Stein is with the Green Party, where she's still asking people to vote for her in the 10 states that could potentially swing the election to Trump. I think I've learned the lesson that, no, the Sanders campaign has provided us with a model, a successful strategy for participating electorally. And we should understand, we had no reason to expect that we were going to win the Democratic nomination through the electoral process this year. The progressive forces in the United States aren't big enough and strong enough to do that. So what we wanted to do was to be able to talk about what does democratic socialism mean to millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. And Bernie Sanders has done that. He has talked about what democratic socialism means to hundreds of millions of U.S. citizens. He has made it a word that isn't a bad word that nobody is, that everybody is afraid to even talk about. And he has pointed out and said over and over again, we are in a situation where people are totally disfranchised. People have no control over what their government's doing anymore. We need a political revolution. So we have a candidate who has said we need a political revolution. We have a candidate who has spoken in concrete terms what democratic socialism can mean and how much better it is than neoliberal capitalism. And he has successfully campaigned and set, and gotten that message out to hundreds of millions of Americans, came very close to winning the Democratic Party nomination. And there are now tens of millions of particularly young Americans who think, I'm for democratic socialism and I'm for a political revolution. That's a tremendous step in the right direction that we have taken during this electoral campaign. It rebounds to the benefit of people building social movements. It basically gives us that missing piece to our overall strategy that we always struggle with. So in that sense, I am very impressed with something that's happened that was beyond any of it was certainly beyond my expectations. I'll go out on a limb. I don't think Bernie Sanders or his closest advisors had a clue that they would be this successful. They never expected to be this successful. So it's a huge and pleasant surprise that we need to recognize the importance of in terms of how we plan about going ahead in the future. We finally, I think, have a basic formula for how we can combine electoral campaigning at the national level with all the other activities that we've been doing for the past 20 years.
We really need to recognize that the road ahead is not an easy one, but that the sheer success of Bernie's campaign reflects exactly that as a society, you know, we have the moral compass to move towards a society that's more, you know, that's built on reciprocity, that's built on interconnection with each other and with the environment, with the natural world, you know, and a society that really hungers for social justice and dignity that is, you know, to all, for all people, not just for a few and for those who can afford to buy it.
I was teaching on a campus this spring, and I was just amazed at how many of the students, this was at Lewis and Clark, which is a fairly affluent student population. I was amazed at just how powerful and overwhelming the sentiment for the Sanders campaign was on that campus. I mean, you look at the primary results, and I mean, he was getting, in the Democratic primaries, he was getting 85% of the vote under 30. From 18 to 30, 85% were voting for a guy who's older than me who's saying, I'm a democratic socialist and we need a political revolution. So in terms of who it is that has been turned on to the kind of ideas, values, politics that we have all believed in for decades and decades, I mean, Bernie did an incredible job of turning the American youth, putting them on a path where they're thinking in the right direction. They're very clear about what they want, and they're very clear about what they're disgusted with. And on those two issues, they're absolutely dead right. They're much more clear-headed than most older Americans are at this point. And the youth's always the future, so there is that to be hopeful for.
Thank you so much for being with us. I highly recommend that people buy your books and support your efforts as well, because you truly are a gift. Thank you very much for all that you do, and thank you for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Sylvia, and good luck to you Canadians.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.